Good afternoon. I want to welcome everyone to the House Committee on Judiciary. Representative Jensen will be joining us later for the committee's information. He is at a water resources meeting at the Water Resource Building. And Representative Shetterly, I also know, will be here a few minutes late. He is testifying on some bills that were up in front of the Rules Committee, so they will be joining us later in the meeting. I understand also that Representative Anderson is on his way, but has been slightly detained. So appreciate all of you being here today and participating in this process. I have some opening remarks today that I want to address to the members of the committee and the participants and those that are attending here at the hearing. Members of the committee, this committee has two primary functions. One is to enact law, and the other is oversight. And today we sit here and exercise our duties of oversight. In the last several years, I have become aware of questions that have been raised concerning extraordinary expenses paid for Oregon's Indigent Defense Services Division and its predecessor. Extraordinary expenses are those which we'll hear a better definition of, but those that pay for such things as investigators, expert witnesses, transcripts, travel, etc. These are not the costs associated with the payment of the attorneys for their actual legal services. To the extent that defendants cannot obtain a fair trial without these extraordinary expenses that are constitutionally mandated, it creates a problem. When the charge is murder and the potential penalty is death by execution or life in prison, both the United States Supreme Court as well as the Oregon Supreme Court is particularly sensitive to the issues of fundamental fairness in a trial. But this does not mean that the state of Oregon is obliged to write a blank check, and there is a substantial amount of judgment that must be exercised in deciding what is required to constitute a constitutionally adequate defense. Under normal circumstances, we would leave this sort of oversight review until our interim legislative session. But as we all know, these are not normal times. Last November, I was informed that our Indigent Defense Fund, as a result of a $27.5 million budget reduction made during our five special sessions, was rapidly running out of funds. As we all know too well, this is not a phenomenon limited to just indigent defense. However, the right to counsel and the right to have a state-appointed counsel is not something that is discretionary with the state. Both the United States and the Oregon constitutions are clear that if we do not appoint counsel in those cases, we do not prosecute. What became clear to me was that Oregon was facing a serious crisis in public safety. As many of you know, I sent a letter to leadership in the Emergency Board urging restoration of sufficient funds to the Indigent Defense Services Division to get us through the remainder of the biennium. These funds had been previously set aside in the E-Fund. We were partially successful in that E-Board gave the fund an additional $5 million. During my communication with the E-Board members about this additional funding, the issue of extraordinary expenses was raised as a basis for not making any additional appropriation. I committed to several members of the E-Board and to leadership that we would more closely examine this issue during the regular session of the legislature. In addition, the Emergency Board has asked us to exercise our powers of oversight to review these indigent defense expenditures. As we all know, as a result of the lawsuit that was filed last Monday against members of the legislature, the additional $5 million was not enough to get the fund through until the end of the fiscal year, June 30th. Pursuant to the Chief Justice's order, starting March 1st, the state of Oregon will not appoint counsel in certain specified cases. The hope is that these matters can stay in limbo until the new fiscal year. Whether they can remains to be seen. The Oregon Supreme Court may order the legislature to add additional funds to indigent defense, or we may see cases dismissed, and certainly the case that was filed obviously remains in question. In addition to my letter about indigent defense funding, I spoke to a number of other legislators, not members of the E-Board, who have raised these questions with me as well. So what we are attempting to do today is to find the facts. Good facts make for good legislation, and if needed, this committee will seek legislation to address any problems that we may find during our 2 days on this subject. If legislation is not needed, then I hope that we can lay this issue to rest and move forward as we discuss other issues related to the appropriate level of indigent defense funding. Some have publicly questioned my wisdom on the timing of this hearing, given the current budget crisis being faced by the state, and particularly the public safety portion of the budget, including courts and the indigent defense budget. Let me address that issue. First, I would say, to the contrary, I think it is absolutely essential that we have this discussion and address these concerns now because of the current budget situation. First, if there are issues that by our intervention can save the system money, we are obligated to determine that as part of our responsibility as the Judiciary Committee and our commitment to fiscal accountability. Second, I committed to members of the E-Board that we would do this review as part of the agreement and the commitment to get the additional $5 million reappropriated to the fund in early January. Third, as I previously stated, we need to resolve this issue before the new commission takes over its responsibilities for oversight of the fund so that if a new authorization process is required, we can help them construct it. Fourth, we need to understand the magnitude of this issue as it is compared to the balance of the indigent defense budget so that it is placed in its proper perspective as we address the larger discussion of indigent defense funding. In an attempt to find good facts and to do so in an orderly manner, I sent a letter dated January 13, 2003 to every district attorney in Oregon asking them for information on excessive or unnecessary extraordinary expenses. In order that Indigent Defense Services could have the opportunity to respond, I asked the district attorneys to give us the following information: the name of the case and the case number, circuit court and judge or judges before whom the case was tried, dates the case were before the case was before the court, defense counsel involved in the case, and the expenses in question and any other relevant information pertaining to indigent defense costs associated with the case. I also asked that they respond by January 30th, 2003. This was done so that we could address these issues in an orderly fashion. By letter dated January 29th, 2003, the district attorney for Clatsop County responded on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. In his letter, he lists 11 cases, all but one of which were capital murder cases. In addition, he listed general comments from two counties and a 1995 Secretary of State audit report. These general comments did not contain the requested information that would have given the Indigent Defense Services Division a chance to respond. Also, the Senate Judiciary Committee reviewed the audit report soon after its release in 1995, and the audit report did not specifically address extraordinary expenses or any of the cases set forth in that letter. By letter dated February 4, 2003, I thanked Mr. Marquis, the district attorney for Clatsop County, for his assistance in the information on the 11 named cases, but also informed him that the other material lacked the requested specific information and would not be considered. He responded with another letter on Friday, February 7th. Accompanying that letter was some additional information concerning some of the general comments in the previous letter. And on the following Monday, we provided this information to Ann Christian, the director of the Indigent Defense Services Division, and asked her to respond, if possible, on shorter notice. And she informed me that she would be prepared to do so. Those comments will be taken tomorrow, Friday, to allow them some additional time to prepare the information. In addition to that letter, I received a letter from Daniel Norris, the district attorney of Mount Hiar County, and an email from Mr. Frank of Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. Mr. Norris's letter did address extraordinary expenses and had the requested information. Mr. Frink's email did not. Nonetheless, I've asked Mrs. Christian to address the issues raised in the email, and she is prepared or will be prepared to do so by tomorrow. Members of the committee, you have before you the agenda, and I plan to move through this agenda in an orderly manner. I will first ask committee counsel to briefly review the documents in your packet. Then I will ask Ms. Christian to put extraordinary expenses in the context of the indigent defense budget and to set forth how extraordinary expenses are authorized, particularly in capital murder cases. At that point, we will ask the Oregon President of the District Attorneys Association to come up and make some brief introductory remarks, and then we will address the issues on a case-by-case basis. The last item of our agenda, which I believe we will not reach until late tomorrow in the hearing, will be some suggestions from Doug Harkelrode, the Lane County District Attorney, and Ross Shefford, the Director of the Public Defender Services of Lane County, on how we might address some of these issues. You will also note in your letter a letter from Mr. Marquis to the media regarding this issue from a follow-up of an earlier conversation, and he was kind enough to include this letter in his material. We welcome any members of the press that are here, but I want to remind everyone here today that this is not a press conference. If you want one, you can step outside the hearing room and move sufficiently away from the door so that you don't interfere with the proceedings. Additionally, we are not here to retry any of these particular cases. We are not a jury, nor are we the judge. I recognize the tension and the passion surrounding these issues as it relates to these specific cases, and I also recognize that our presenters today are professional advocates skilled in their art. but I will be exercising the prerogative of the chair to keep us focused on the issue of extraordinary expenses and the particular examples that will be set out before us today. If you stray beyond that, you may find yourself ruled out of order. I am requesting that you stick to the facts of the case set forth in the agenda. The proceeding is not an indictment of the indigent defense system, nor is it an indictment of our district attorneys. So we are all clear, this hearing is not about a review of the constitutional right to counsel. It is not about the comparison of state funding of indigent defense and the district attorney system. It is not about the 1995 audit report by the Secretary of State. This proceeding is a legislature exercising its oversight function to determine if legislation is needed to address the particular problem of extraordinary expenses within the indigent defense system. Thank you. Counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, you have a packet before you that was delivered, I believe, 2 days ago. First off, you have the letter of January 13, 2003, addressed to Mr. Bradley Berry, Yamhill District Attorney, who is the legislative chair for their association, asking for the information that you've already mentioned. The next part of your packet is a letter dated January 22, 2003, from the Honorable Daniel A. Norris, and this is the information that he has concerning State v. McKnight. Next letter in your packet is a letter dated January 29, 2003, with attached material from Mr. Marquis on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association with attachments. Following that is a letter dated, it's actually undated, but it was received in our office last Friday at approximately 2:10 with additional information coming from Mr. Marquis. It was faxed to us. Then you have, following that is an undated, February 7th, 2003 letter to KPTV. Then after that you have an email from Norman Frank. Concerning, I guess, State v. Lloyd. And finally, we just received this, I believe, yesterday or the day before yesterday, a letter from Michelle Longo Etter in response to the first case before us, the Jones matter, the 1985 case out of Lincoln County.
Okay, with that, we would ask Ms. Christian if you're ready to come up and make your initial presentation. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Christian. I'm director of the Indigent Defense Services Division. It's a division within the State Court Administrator's Office. As I stated the last time I appeared before you in January, I do sincerely appreciate your time and your special attention to issues related to public defense, the public defense function in Oregon. As you'll recall, and as detailed in more so in my written testimony, we have appeared before you on two occasions already during the session. On January 15th, the Department of Justice and we provided you information with regard to the right to counsel. We've also appeared before you in the role of the new Public Defense Services Commission with some proposed legislation. A significant portion of what I'm going to testify to today is with regard to what the law is, with regard to extraordinary expenses, what the process is, what the expenditures are, and who processes, who decides what extraordinary expenses are pre-authorized. I welcome an opportunity for a public hearing on this topic, which really is a right to counsel issue. It's in a different context than what we talked with you in January. The hearings today will focus on the specific context within which an individual is entitled to what I call extraordinary, non-lawyer, non-routine expenses is what's used in the legislation for the Public Defense Services Commission, those types of resources that are part of one's right to effective legal representation. And I provided you the cite to the United States Supreme Court case that first held that there was a denial of expert assistance is reversible error, and that was in a death penalty case. We have many individuals here today from outside the Salem and even the Valley area. I have an opportunity to be here. I will be here through the entire hearings. I plan to give you a quick overview of what are extraordinary expenses, what's involved, and what's the history. And then I would like to be able to participate in the individual specific case discussions that you will be hearing. The first issue is the law. Quickly, the law is set forth in the written testimony. Oregon law is by statute and by constitution, and it provides for the provision of extraordinary expenses for a few examples quickly. To communicate with, so a criminal defendant can communicate with and understand his attorney in the court. That will be an issue when we get to the case of Manzo Hernandez from Klamath County. Expenses so that the defendant can understand the proceeding, similar to linguistic understanding, and assist his or her attorney in their defense. These are psychologists that are frequently sought permission for. Also, individuals to garner evidence and witnesses for the defense, the investigators in the cases. An opportunity to subject the state's evidence to review and or provide his counsel with the basis to better understand the evidence. And I do have testimony that I will, not testimony, but a letter from Jim Pex, who many of you are familiar with many years of experience with the state crime lab, that I will provide tomorrow. Finally, a major portion, and a lot of people don't realize this, a major portion of the almost $9 million per year that's spent on extraordinary expenses, $1.1 million of that is for transcripts. That's another right that an individual, it's a constitutional right that an individual has, at least for their first appeal from a criminal conviction. And next issue is, so who decides and who reviews when a defense attorney, and I will focus, Mr. Chair, primarily on death penalty cases, who decides when to authorize an extraordinary expense? Historically, in Oregon, it has been judges who decide whether a request for such an expense is approved or denied. And I started in my position 14 years ago, and I saw many judges feel uncomfortable with the role in which they were placed. The independent arbiter also deciding expenses for one side. The other thing I observed was a continuum of decisions, as one can well expect out of all of the circuit court judges making decisions with regard to extraordinary expenses. And of course, the continuum started at this level, or as a quick example, a Marion County case in the early 1990s that exceeded $1 million. And I'm not being critical in any of my remarks, because as we'll get to, I now am the person who reviews all requests in death penalty cases. And it is a difficult, difficult job. The 1995 Legislative Assembly amended ORS 135055 to allow for the administrative rather than judicial review of extraordinary expense requests. The legislative history shows that the change was intended to provide greater consistency and the centralization of the review process. And I do mention that there were some judges who felt uncomfortable with the position they were put in, making decisions with regard to the expenses of one side. Finally, some attorneys, with regard to the legislative history, were concerned with providing detailed affidavits in support of their requests to judges that would disclose information to the judge who ultimately would decide the defendant's fate. That doesn't apply to death penalty cases. Due to the fact that there were no resources, it's one of those situations where we requested, the Judicial Department requested the legislative change, and we were successful in obtaining legislative change. We were not successful in obtaining the staffing to take over the judicial, what had been a judicial responsibility. So the decision was made to limit the number of cases in which administrative, central, me, administrative review would occur. And this is what has been in process. This has been the process since January 1996. So of the cases that are on our list for the hearings during the next 2 days, some of them are under the pre-1996 judge review of extraordinary expense. This works well because you'll have different models. I don't know if I'd call them models, but different systems to compare against. Some of them are pure administrative review, meaning a person in Salem centralized. And a third portion of them are what I would term administrative peer review, administrative slash peer review. Those are three cases on your list or hearings today where the extraordinary expenses are reviewed by the executive director of the contractor, criminal defense contractor we have here in Salem, Mr. Gorham. When the Public Defense Services Commission assumes responsibility very soon for what currently is termed the Indigent Defense Program, all requests for extraordinary expenses will be reviewed and decided centrally and administratively. We will no longer have this bifurcated system. And council will retain the right to appeal an adverse decision to a local judge. I think there sometimes is some confusion with regard to review of extraordinary expenses. There are really two aspects. Oregon law requires that such expenses be pre-authorized, not just authorized after the fact. And that was a change that I put in for legislative action, I believe in 1995. The years are running together, so forgive me if it wasn't then, but I'm 90% certain. So all requests for extraordinary expenses must be pre-authorized. The other side is, when services have been provided, someone must review the bill that comes in. And that's a separate process now, but that process as well, reviewing the actual billing from an expert or from an investigator, when the commission assumes responsibility, will transfer centrally, essentially into the Office of Public Defense Services, which we all will be a part of. I can only believe that that will make for a much better system for both the pre-authorization and the bill review process. And because I want to put all this in context, Mr. Chair, as you asked, for the fiscal year 2002, so the most recent that we have complete information, and the last year in which we had what I would call a halfway normal budget, non-attorney expenditures from the indigent defense account, the entire account, were about $75 million. The extraordinary expenses in all of the case types, you may recall when we talked about right to counsel, termination of parental rights, dependency, all criminal cases, and appeals from all those, the extraordinary expenses, except in the death penalty cases, totaled $6.9 million. 1.1 of that was for transcripts on appeal. That's about 8%. For trial-level non-aggravated murder cases, and this is why I am so particularly interested and thankful for the assistance of the commission and this committee with regard to this topic, extraordinary expenses in death penalty cases accounted for, for trial-level, just a minute, aggravated murder, I'm sorry, it is 37% of the total expenditures. It's $2 million per year. And so it is a significant part of the extraordinary expenses, which total $8.9 million. The largest expenditure or type of expenditure that indigent defense pays for, 75% of the funds, just to give you another context, 75% of the funds pay for the local contractors in your community, the attorneys who actually provide the legal representation. So that's the largest portion of our budget. Quickly, and I'm almost done, the rates of denial since I started doing the review in 1996. I've found the task difficult. I, in certain cases, have engaged others in making some hard decisions. And the most recent data I have, and I thought that this would be pertinent, for calendar, and this is for all expenses, in Measure 11, in death penalty cases that I review, 17% of the cases, of the requests to me were authorized, but authorized only in part. This frequently is the result of my talking with the lawyer and saying, isn't there an alternative? Isn't there a cheaper way to do something? 4% of the requests I reviewed during that past year were not authorized at all, and the remainder, 79%, were authorized in full. That 79% that were authorized in full compares to 91% authorized during 1998. 1998 was a big year as far as expenses for indigent defense. In closing, the specific cases and expenses to be addressed during the next portion of these hearings are ones that cover the gamut with respect to mode of review, whether it's judge, whether it's administrative, slash peer review. And I think this is good because the Public Defense Services Commission, of which the chair and the executive director are here with you today, Mr. Barnes Ellis and Mr. Peter Ozan, is very interested in working on this issue. And I welcome the opportunity, Mr. Chair, personally, as far as the opportunity to work with you and others in this regard. I think it's important that the committee have an opportunity to hear from the individuals to the extent we were able to bring them in today. One or two will be here tomorrow. But so that you can hear from defense attorneys with regard to the need keen to these specific cases for the extraordinary expenses that have been raised in Mr. Marquis's letter. And I ask you to allow me the opportunity to come up and explain my decisions, but I think it might be good, at least for as many cases as you have time, to have the prosecution and the defense discuss with you their side of it and picture how difficult sometimes it is to make these decisions. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer questions at any point during these hearings.
Okay, thank you, Anne. Colleagues, we'll take a few questions, bearing in mind the length of the agenda. So, and our opportunity to get specific on some of the examples as the hearing proceeds. Representative Prozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you can give me two dates just for a point of clarification. You began in your position reviewing these different requests in 1996?
Correct.
And you also said that at some point, I didn't catch the year, they were required to be pre-authorized?
I believe that was the same legislation, the 95 session, okay, but I would want to check.
Approximately the same time frame
correct.
That you took over.
As correct.
And prior to that, there was not the requirement for pre-authorization. The expense was, incurred, and then it was basically asked to be authorized?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prozanski, as a statutory matter, prior to 1995, I'm pretty sure, the statute required authorization, and it did not say authorization. I put in place a policy statement, I believe in 1991, I'm certain of that now, that required pre-authorization. The difficulty with having that requirement only in a policy statement is sometimes people don't read the policy statement. People I've found, at least so far, more likely to look at the statute, which is also good. So I thought it prudent to have it in both policy and statute.
Additional questions? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I might have to ask two or three questions here because I'm not unfamiliar with the with this system, although my knowledge is a little bit dated. But getting to your report, You mentioned the word open authorization, and 75% of requests were authorized in full. Does this tell me that your office does not have any standards upon which to evaluate requests for these services? And does it tell me that your office does not have any lids or caps on hourly rates, expenses, or cumulative totals for such services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I see that as two questions.
It is.
The 79%, does that indicate we have no standards? The answer is no. We have a policy statement that provides certain rates with regard to extraordinary expenses. It is outdated. I'm being upfront, but there are provisions with regard to the hourly rates. For example, for forensic services, $75 per hour. The standard statutorily is reasonable and necessary. And that, I like to think of, it's flipped. It should be, is the expense necessary? That's the first question. And the second question to be answered is, provided it is necessary, is the amount requested reasonable? So, in other words, if it's necessary for a psychologist to examine a defendant for purposes of aid and assist, as an example, that's one issue. The second issue is the provider who's proposed reasonable? To answer your second question, are there standards with regard to lids or caps on particular case types or hourly rates?
Either.
With regard to particular case types, the answer is no. Multnomah County locally has some administrative presumed caps with regard to, I know, misdemeanor cases. And with regard to hourly rates, the policy I've referred to sets the rates as guideline rates that are subject to deviation given, for instance, the local community. In Eastern Oregon, we find we do not have sufficient number of local psychologists. So there certainly could be greater standards put in place, and that's something that, you know, the commission may want to look at.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you, Ann. Next, I'm going to invite Gary Williams, who is the district attorney from Crook County, to come forward, and he is also the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Welcome, Mr. Williams.
Thank you. Chair Williams and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Gary Williams. I am from Crook County and privileged to be the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association for 2003. My primary role today is simply to introduce Oregon prosecutors who will be making statements to you today and tomorrow. But before I do that, I would like to thank the chair and the committee for inviting Oregon District Attorneys to provide you with information regarding indigent defense extraordinary expenses. We are very pleased to respond to that invitation. Our written report, which the chair referred to a few moments ago, the 10-page report, and our statements today are not attacks against individual defense lawyers, nor are they attacks against the indigent defense function. Oregon district attorneys believe that indigent defense providers generally do an excellent job in our courts every day across Oregon. And of course, we are not here today to throw rocks at Ann Christian, who we respect and with whom we have a very positive working relationship. Today and tomorrow we will provide statements regarding most of the cases that are listed on our 10-page report. And following me today, with the chair's permission, and not necessarily in this order, will be Paul Frazier, Chief Deputy District Attorney in Coos County, Dale Penn, District Attorney in Marion County, Stephanie Tuttle and Steve Dingle, both deputy district attorneys in Marion County, Joshua Marquis, district attorney in Clatsop County, Norm Frink, chief deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, Mike Dugan, district attorney in Deschutes County, Ed Caleb, district attorney in Klamath County, Dan Norris, district attorney from Malheur County, who is expected to arrive shortly from South Carolina, coming in on, I think, an 11:30 flight to Portland. So we presume that he will be here prior to the close of the hearing. Doug Harkelrode, district attorney in Lane County, as the chair indicated, will complete our presentation tomorrow with some proposed solutions for fiscal accountability, including but not limited to peer review. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. At this point, we're going to take these in order on the agenda, with the exception of we have a couple, at least one case, and I don't have the agenda that I wrote that on. Yeah, I think in the case of State versus Garner, due to some availability issues, we're going to keep that one or try to move that one till Friday, when the lawyers will be present, and this will be a bit of a work in process. So if there is some other juggling that we have to do, we're willing to accommodate that as well. So we're going to start, I think, with the presentation on State versus Jones. I don't know who's responsible, and I'm just going to sort of call the case, and I apologize for not knowing everybody who's involved in that case. What our preference would be is that we have the presentation with respect to the issues involving the expenses raised in the report submitted by the district attorneys, and then the response by the indigent defense services folks. So that's the procedure in which we'll operate. So is someone ready on the State versus Jones? Is that you, Mr. Marquis?
That's one of the cases I
thought. Oh, okay, great. If you want to come forward then and begin your presentation, then we'll move on to the response.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joshua Marquis. I'm the district attorney of Clatsop County. I've been the district attorney for almost 10 years. I've been a deputy district attorney in three other Oregon counties, Lincoln County, Deschutes County, and Lane County. And I have a somewhat unique perspective, having served as indigent defense capital attorney for about 18 months in 1989 and 90. So I've tried capital defenses as both a prosecutor and as a defender. And as my letter indicates, we're happy to respond to Chairman Williams' request for specifics. It is difficult to respond specifically because Oregon law does not allow us access to information so long as a case is under appeal. In capital cases, as most of you probably know, if they're litigated, they're still under appeal. There's the first capital murder in Oregon is McDonnell. I don't think it's even entered the 12 to 15 year appellate process. So for a practical matter, we know about these cases anecdotally. There one exception is the State versus Simpkins matter, which resulted in an acquittal, and in which case we have details. I'm glad to hear the chairman say that we're not relitigating these issues. I saw Ms. Longo, who's here's response, four-page response, and a lot of it seems to deal with the issues of whether the case was well taken, whether there should have been a conviction, which there was originally, of the juvenile, which was overturned. As I understand it, the issues before the chair wants addressed have to do with indigent defense. And I want to re-stress, because this is extraordinarily important, that both the Oregon and federal constitutions require adequate defense. And I debate the death penalty all over this country, and I'm proud of the fact that Oregon provides quality indigent defense. Not merely a Vega or an old Valiant, but, you know, at least a new shiny Chevrolet, if not an Oldsmobile. The question is, should it be a Lamborghini or a Rolls Royce? I want to point out that there has not been a single case in recent Oregon history in which the appellate courts have upheld the reversal for inadequate assistance of counsel for refusal to provide, by either Ms. Christian or by the trial judge, expert witnesses or extraordinary expenses. I cited the first case because, again, it's mostly anecdotal, simply because it was and it's, if Ms. Longo remembers more details, she'll do, I think she already does. That was almost 17 years ago. It was my first murder case. It was before the current indigent defense system existed. So many of the, if there were problems, have probably been addressed at least once or twice. I raised that case because it was my first experience with significant amounts of indigent defense. I appreciate Ms. Longo promoting me to chief deputy, but I was only a deputy DA at the time. And again, I don't want to get into the details of the merits of the case. Ms. Longo indicates that Judge Haas had removed myself from the case for misconduct. That's not accurate. But the issues which I see Ms. Longo has addressed, and the two things that struck me when I tried that case, which was admittedly my first murder trial, was that there were three lawyers on the other side. Jerry Spence, who many of you may know is a famous attorney from Wyoming, his partner, Edward Moriarty. They had volunteered their services pro bono, so theoretically they weren't costing the taxpayers anything. And Stephen Lovejoy, who was originally assigned to represent the juvenile. This was a murder case arising out of a property dispute up Eminen Road, which if any of you have ever driven past Salishan is the road that, if you're driving south, is the last turn to the left before you get to Salishan. And it occurred in the summer of 1985, and Michael Jones, age 15, and his mother, Sandra Jones, were accused of murdering Wilford Gertula by shooting him with some kind of weapon. We weren't really sure what. There was one eyewitness to the crime, the widow of the victim. I tried the juvenile case. I did not try the case, and actually in which Ms. Longo was the attorney. What the issues that I brought up, and I'm here prepared to address about the Jones case, are fairly limited, and that is that in that case, not only was the child, the 15-year-old, this is before the, obviously the existing law took, where he would be tried as an adult, was in effect. He was tried as a juvenile, which meant he had every right except the right to a jury trial, essentially. Every other procedural right was in place. He had two, to put it mildly, skilled attorneys. Certainly Mr. Spence and his associate were skilled lawyers. And Mr. Lovejoy, who would have probably been more than capable of handling the case by himself. I tried the case alone as the prosecutor. What struck me, Ms. Longo was the lawyer who was slated to represent the mother, Mrs. Jones, and did in fact represent Mrs. Jones along with Mr. Spence in the subsequent trial, which didn't take place, I think, until almost 3 years later. And the two issues I brought up were that Ms. Longo was present during the entire juvenile trial, I'm assuming not on her own dime. That would be useful, I would think, as an attorney. I have no idea how much it costs. I'm assuming a substantial amount of money. Obviously, she didn't participate in Michael Jones's defense because she was representing the mother, Sandra Jones. The other issue I raised, which apparently I was correct in, although I didn't know the details, was that, and I think that this time the trial judge, according to Ms. Longo, and I'm sure she's correct, authorized this expense. Ms. Longo, Lincoln County stretches about, I don't know, 60 miles, I think, from Land's End down to the south, near south of Walport. And Ms. Longo can tell you better where she was living, but she was living in the north part of the county or at her office. And the indigent defense, or whatever it was called then, provided for her to be housed in Newport, which is the county seat, to accommodate her schedule so she wouldn't have to drive to or from work. I've certainly lived in counties where I've had to work, drive 45 or 50 minutes one way. My employer's never offered to rent me a room for a month or two. But those are the only issues that I raised regarding the Jones case. They are, again, anecdotal, as many of these are, because for the most part we're not aware of information. As I understand it, Mr. Chairman, you want to take these cases one at a time, correct?
I do, and the reason I do, Mr. Marquis, and for the others here in the room, is that I'm afraid that if we had all of them at once on one side and then all of them at once on the other side, we would never be able to circle back and talk about the individual issues. Sure. So it's to give both sides an opportunity to address the issue of the case that was raised directly in front of us.
I'm not going to go into the other issues this is the first time I've seen Ms. Longo Eater's letter about discovery issues.
I think we did actually have it faxed to your office when we
I've been over here since yesterday.
You've been over here, so it probably missed you in the process. But I appreciate that because the focus really is on the issue of the extraordinary expenses that you raised with the case, and that's where I want to keep the committee focused as well. So I appreciate you limiting your comments. At this point, then, we would ask Ms. Etter to come up and make her presentation. Mr. Markey, you might stay simply so when we're done, the committee can pose any questions that they might have to either of you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity today to present testimony. By way of introduction, I have practiced law almost 24 years. The first 10 years of my practice, I provided criminal indigent legal services to clients by way of appointments from the court. I have served as a municipal court judge in Lincoln City and also act as an arbitrator in Lincoln County. During the time, members of the committee, that I served as municipal court judge, that court had jurisdiction over misdemeanors. And so I have also had the experience of reviewing the appointments of attorneys as well as their petitions for court-appointed attorney's fees. For the last 14 years, I have represented commercial fishing businesses and their trade associations in front of state and federal regulatory agencies. Currently, I've been appointed by Attorney General Hardy Myers as a Special Assistant Attorney General, representing the Oregon Trawl Commission in a trade action before the Department of Commerce and the International Trade Commission against the Government of Canada regarding the importation of pink shrimp. I also serve currently as the President of the Lincoln County Bar Association. I understand that you are reviewing allegations of abusive spending in some criminal indigent defense cases. I reviewed Mr. Markey's statements regarding a case that I was involved in, State versus Sandra Jones, which began in 1985 and concluded with her acquittal by a jury in 1989. In July 1985, I was court-appointed to represent Sandra Jones, who was charged with murder in the shooting of a man named Will Gertula. Her 15-year-old son, Michael Jones Jr., was also charged with committing the same murder in the juvenile court, and Steve Lovejoy was appointed to represent him. Euless Stapleton was then district attorney of Lincoln County and was to prosecute the case against the mother. Mr. Markey was not its chief deputy, but was a deputy in the office at the time and assigned to prosecute the teenage boy. Both Mr. Markey and Mr. Stapleton refused to identify prior to trial which individual they believed was the actual shooter, instead alleging that either the mother or the son fired the murder weapon, and whoever didn't actually kill Mr. Gertula was guilty by way of accomplice liability. In the fall of 1985, because of the district attorney's failure to timely provide discovery to me, despite my repeated requests, it was necessary for me to file with the court three separate motions to compel discovery of police reports from the DA's office. On each occasion, Judge Gardner, from Benton County, sitting as a Lincoln County judge, ordered Mr. Stapleton to provide discovery, which should have been provided voluntarily under the prosecutor's statutory obligations. The mother's trial was initially set for October and then reset until January 6, 1986. The boy's trial was set to begin in December 1985. In November 1985, Jerry Spence and his partner Edward Moriarty came to Lincoln County and volunteered to assist Steve Lovejoy and represent the boy in the juvenile trial. Based on all the exculpatory evidence in their possession, Mr. Spence, Mr. Lovejoy, and Mr. Moriarty, immediately before the start of the boy's trial, laid out their case to Judge Gardner, Mr. Stapleton, and Mr. Markey. I was not allowed to be present and was not privy to their presentation or the conclusions of their expert witnesses or their investigators or their work product. Defense counsel for the boy sought to have the prosecutors dismiss their case pre-trial. The prosecutors refused. The matter proceeded to trial. The boy was found to be within the jurisdiction of the court by Judge Gardner on the charge of manslaughter. At this point, let me first address Mr. Markey's spurious allegation that it was an abuse of indigent defense funds for me to sit through the juvenile trial to hear the evidence to be presented against the boy, the same evidence that was expected to be used 3 weeks later against my client, the mother. First, my request to do so was made in advance of trial to the presiding judge in the case, Judge Gardner, who approved the initial expenditure and reviewed every dime. Judge Gardner was aware that it had been necessary to order the DA Stapleton to provide me with a statutory discovery I was entitled to, and had expressed concern about the DA's conduct in being less than cooperative. Secondly, the DA, for 5 months, had refused to identify which person they believed to be the shooter, severely hampering my ability to prepare a defense on behalf of my client. Third, the judge knew that the defense of the boy, to wit, that neither he or his mother had shot Mr. Grutula, was then one that I had not been privy to, and that my presence at the trial to hear the testimony of witnesses would allow me to keep from having to reinvent the wheel, so to speak, in the defense of the mother. Let me address Mr. Marquis's other allegation that it was an abusive indigent defense funding system and that the fund paid for my housing expenses in Newport. My home was not in Lincoln City. Where my home was, frankly, is irrelevant. It was even further north. My law office was located at the very north end of Lincoln City, and it took 45 minutes each way, on a good day, for a total of 90 minutes to get from my office to the courthouse and back. Under the statutory, or excuse me, not statutory scheme at the time, but under the provisions that the judges applied at the time, I was entitled to be paid for that time. In an effort to save money, I sat down pre-trial with Judge Gardner in chambers, as was the custom, and reviewed the fact that if I were not compensated for commute time, it would be significantly less expensive that I be reimbursed for housing expenses in Newport during the trial. Judge Gardner reviewed each detail of a sworn affidavit I presented to him regarding costs, saw that it would indeed save money, and improved it. I might add that this was the case in each application I made requesting funds. I submitted the information first in affidavit form. Judge Gardner would review it line by line, call me in if he had any questions, and then would approve the requested expenditures. Judge Gardner never found any request for funds that I made to be anything other than reasonable and appropriate to the defense of a woman charged with murder.
Ms. Etter, this is where I'm going to stop you from continuing to read your testimony. You've responded to the two issues with respect to the extraordinary expenses, and I appreciate that. The committee has your letter. It's been accepted as part of the record. It was distributed by me in advance of the hearing along with the other materials. The second half of your letter gets into issues not directly related to extraordinary expenses, and while this is a difficult job for me to define where to cut these things off at, and I obviously allowed a little bit of latitude to set the stage of this case by Mr. Marquis and a little to you to respond to your involvement in the case, I'm going to narrow our focus really on indigent expenses at this time. I encourage all of you to continue to discuss some of the other issues and about how there is two sides to this equation anytime you're in a case where either side can do things which can increase substantially the cost of the trial. But in order to keep order and with the initial opening comments that I made, I am going to ask you to cut your testimony off at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Etter. At that point now, I will open it up to questions to either of these two witnesses about the specific issues involving the extraordinary expenses raised at this point. Are there any questions of the committee? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I've read through the incomplete file, this case, and all the documents that have been sent to me. And I probably, like some folks in this room, started out my trial experience with court-appointed cases when I was admitted to the bar in 1963. And I think my general question, and I think it's a common theme that I've had in almost every criminal case, is that the lack of early disposition of criminal cases. And I realize that could relate to a staffing problem, a communication problem, a discovery gridlock, and just pure procrastination by both sides. So I'm not saying that we all haven't done that at one time or another. I was impressed perhaps about a year ago when I believe more than one judge had a primary role in Lane County in coming to a pretrial disposition of the case of State versus Kinkle. And I'm just wondering if part of the remedy here isn't a some form of, I will say, settlement conference or some sort of pre-trial conference with the judge, if necessary, to resolve these cases. Or what would you see? Or basically, is my basic theme correct or not? I don't want to make a speech here, but I do know that in my experience, I think it's probably a staffing problem, we rarely get significant offers in criminal cases until the day of trial. Okay. So Mr. maybe you'd like to comment on those observations.
Do you have a chance to respond to Representative Ackerman's question, Ms. Etter?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, because I no longer active practice criminal defense law, I'm not as familiar with what the systems are in place throughout the state. I do know that when a trial date is set, and this can vary from county to county, once a trial date is set prior to, a person is arraigned at the time they're first brought before the court, seeing if they qualify for counsel. In Lincoln County, what happens is that a trial date is not then set. What is set is a settlement conference date of sorts, as you suggest, and it's at by that date, and I believe it's usually set out within, as long as the person's not in custody, within 30 days after the date of their first arraignment. And that is the time at which all discovery should be completed, and if there are going to be plea negotiation offers, that those plea negotiation offers then be made. If the case is not resolved by the time of the pretrial conference, then the matter is set for trial. So I think there is an orientation towards trying to get an early resolution, as you suggest, because that is definitely something that is going to be cost-effective for the taxpayers. But I also know that certain circumstances, sometimes the facts of the case, are such that they may not be able to be developed, or certain experts may need to be retained to examine certain facts about the case, such that that simply can't be done that quickly. But my experiences in Lincoln County is that a trial date is not set until those matters are flushed out, and then hopefully we don't have those trial dates lost if a matter does occasionally still plead out at trial.
Ms. Markey, do you want to make a brief response to the question?
Sure. Let me speak first to the case in question. I think Ms. Eder and I may actually be able to agree on this one. I don't think a settlement conference in that case. Actually, Judge Gardner did one, and he did his best. This was a murder charge. The defense of both Ms. Longo's client and the boy, young man who was charged, was that they were innocent. There was, as I recall, again, it was 17 years ago, there was no resolution short of a dismissal that was acceptable to Mr. Spence. And at least in the Michael Jones case, I didn't try the Sandra Jones case. But there are many cases, Mr. Ackerman and Chair Williams, where it's very useful. In my office, offers go out with every single witness letter. I try to get my deputies to do it immediately. This committee, I think, in the legislature passed SB 133, the early disposition program, modeled on something that Ross Shepard and Doug Harkerode could probably talk about better tomorrow, where we've implemented that, regardless of whether or not indigent defense can or will participate, where we try to make basically blue light special offers. That tends to deal with lower end cases. And in fairness to the defense bar, if I had a client charged with a Measure 11 offense, I probably, as Ms. Eder said, would probably want to look at things pretty carefully. But I think settlement conferences are useful.
And I really do want to encourage us, and I appreciate Representative Ackerman's question, and I think we can have a larger discussion about the broader context of how to improve the system. But I do want to keep us, given our time frame, we're not going to get through this if we broaden our discussion too much into broader issues of criminal and judicial policy. So if there are any other questions for the witnesses on this matter, yes, Representative Shetterly.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. There is one statement that relates to this cost issue that is later in Ms. Eder's letter that Mr. Markey might respond to, and this is, again, we don't have the full letter in front of us, but she's quoting a letter opinion from Judge Harl Haas, who apparently got involved in the case later on, and the statement relating to cost says, the cost of the special prosecution team, defense team cost, and venue change cost has been substantial. I think there seems to be agreement on costs in this case being substantial. The unfortunate cost of this case, as in other Lincoln County cases in the last year and a half, rests at the feet of the Lincoln County prosecutor and Mr. Markey. I guess if you'd care to respond to that.
Well, I won't take the hours of the time that took at that time. Judge Haas did disqualify the district attorney's office, specifically claiming a conflict by Mr. Stapleton specifically. I believe at that time I had already filed a judicial fitness complaint against Judge Haas. There was a lot of rancor in that case. Judge Haas dismissed the charge against Sandra Jones and was overturned by the Oregon Court of Appeals that ordered it be retried. I obviously disagree with Judge Haas, and again, I'm assuming the chairman does not want to get into a relitigation of this case or the issues that Judge Haas, who has become very close friends, I understand, with the defense counsel and frequently visits him in Wyoming now.
Any additional questions? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I understand, if I'm correct, that the defense side costs cannot be let out. Is that correct?
Not.
Those are sealed until a finalist disposition?
I believe so. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, until a case is at its conclusion, I believe, until all appeals are concluded, then I believe that information is not part of the public record.
So we don't know exactly, but could you give me your impression as to whether the defense or the prosecution expenses in this case were greater?
My estimate would be that the prosecution costs in this case were substantially greater. And if I may take a moment, Mr. Chair and Mr. Anderson, to explain why. At the time, at the conclusion of the Boyes case, Mr. Stapleton made extrajudicial statements to the press relative to the fact that if Mr. Spence was associated with me in the defense of the mother, that that would be unethical and that I could be disbarred. As a result of those public statements to the press, we filed a motion to disqualify the prosecutor because they had poisoned the jury pool. As a result of that, Judge Gardner had been, it's a side story, but Judge Haas had a hearing, took testimony from Mr. Stapleton, and found that based on the conduct of the prosecutors, that Mr. Stapleton had to be removed from the case and disqualified also Mr. Marquis from being the prosecutor.
Okay,
excuse me, Mr. Chairman, may I?
Very, very briefly. Shortly. I'm serious, guys.
I know.
We're gonna not retry this case. We are not the jury. We are not Judge Haas. We are not the Oregon Court of Appeals. I don't care really how this case turned out. I care about the extraordinary expense issue, and we've addressed it. And again, colleagues, these letters and these issues raise some very interesting issues, and ones that I encourage you to pursue independently if you want to pursue them. But we're never going to get done with this if we don't proceed.
Mr. Chairman.
You've got 30 seconds to answer Representative Ackerman's question.
I've heard the answer. I'd just like to hear, do you agree with that?
In the Michael Jones case, the case that I tried, I know that the indigent defense expenses greatly exceeded that. There was actually a news story, and I think actually because that case is resolved, I think that matter would be subject to public inspection. In the Sandra Jones case, Ms. Longo is probably right. Judge Haas insisted on appointing Mr. Brown, who's present in the courtroom, and required the county to pay him an hourly rate rather than allowing the Attorney General's office to prosecute the case.
Okay, you have your last couple of seconds because I cut you off.
I think the fundamental point of my testimony is, as you look at how the extraordinary expenses of the defense bar, to please also look at how the conduct of the prosecutor's offices across the state of Oregon repeatedly play a significant role in the requests for expenses on the indigent defense fund.
Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Appreciate you.
Chair, could I ask you a question that's not related to the case?
No.
Okay, thank you.
No. Yes, Gary. What's your question?
Mike, two very quick questions. Is a budget presented for consideration for the defense when a case is going to go to trial? And then, what is the average cost of a defense for a murder trial? I mean, if I were arrested for murder and I was going to hire you to defend me, what would it cost?
Couldn't afford me.
Okay, if I was going to hire
Representative Shetterly or Mr. Ackerman.
Okay, if I was going to hire one of those two, what would it cost me?
You know what? We're not going to do this now.
All right.
Those are good, Jerry. Those are good questions, Representative Crummell. Those are good questions. I'll ask you that you provide the answers to those questions to the committee as a whole, maybe in your summing up. Let's keep a list of the ongoing questions. We can sum up. Is that all right with you, Representative Crummell?
All right.
We'll move on to the next matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
This is going to be a circus. All right.
It is.
The next case is State versus Guzik.
Guzik.
Guzik. E.K. Guzik.
Chairman Williams and members of the committee, I'm Mike Dugan. I'm the district attorney for Deschutes County. And Stavy Guzik is a Deschutes County case that occurred in 1987. Guzik 1 was tried, I think, in 1989. It was reversed on by the Supreme Court of Oregon because the U.S. Supreme Court changed some law, added a fourth question. Guzik 2 was tried in Deschutes County. It was reversed because the Oregon Supreme Court had a disagreement with the trial court with regard to some evidence that was admitted. And Guzik 3 was tried in Deschutes County, and my chief deputy at the time was Mr. Marquis. So he will address the committee with regard to the concerns of that case.
Thank you, Mr. Dugan.
Chairman Williams, members.
Hold on. Mr. Dugan, before you leave,
I just want to make certain that are we hearing only about Guzik 3, or are we hearing about 1, 2, and 3?
I think we're hearing right now only about Guzik 3.
Okay. That's all my only intention.
That was Mr. Marquis's case.
Mr. Chairman, I'm the author of this 10-page opus you got, mainly because everybody submitted materials to me and asked me to condense them. I want the committee to know that I didn't use about two-thirds of them because they weren't specific enough, they didn't address the committee's concerns, or they were more debatable. And to answer Representative Brzezanski's question, I was the trial prosecutor in Guzik 2 and 3, but as in many cases in the Guzik 2 prosecution, although I'm sure it was very expensive, I didn't see any issues involving abuse of indigent expenses that drew my attention. They had expert witnesses. They had three lawyers at one point, but it was a capital case. And so my only comments are about Guzik, but what we call Guzik 3. I see Mr. McCabe is here, and I'm sure he'll be able to respond, although I'm hoping that we're not going to get into the sort of back and forth that we did with Ms. Longo about who was unethical and how much discovery was made. Again, the issues are abusive or questionable indigent defense. Guzik is a case about which I can't possibly know because it's still under appeal. In fact, it's likely to be reversed again. So most of what I know about the Guzik 3 case is anecdotal because I was there. What I listed in my letter was I know from speaking to simply jail officers that a number of psychologists were called upon the defendant in the jail. I know no psychologists were ever listed. I never received any discovery from any psychologists. Mr. Guzik never personally testified in any of his three trials. I suppose it might be helpful to know what the defendant was thinking. But again, I'm sort of groping in the dark here because I'm sure there might be circumstances under which having a psychologist, even if your client is never going to testify, might aid you somehow in your defense. But again, I sort of don't know. I'm flying blind. The thing that struck me the most, in addition, there was an expert witness named Dr. Mark Cunningham, whose name you'll see throughout. Dr. Mark Cunningham charges about $20,000 a pop and has testified on behalf of a number of aggravated murder defendants, all of whom seem to get the death penalty, so I'm not sure why the defense bar keeps bringing him back from Texas. But the one issue that I raised had to do with the use of or flying a woman from London. A pen pal, apparently, that the defendant, who is a very charming sociopath, who's been on death row now for 14 or 15 years, had befriended. Her name was not listed as a witness, and I only learned about it because I read about it in the newspaper, the Ben Bulletin. I've attached that article, and actually I learned about it by reading it in the newspaper simultaneously with finding out that this woman, whoever she was, wanted to meet with Mr. Guzik. At the time, the issue was raised. Mr. McCabe, who is here and apparently will be able to respond, I read in the newspaper this morning that he's advised that amount was not paid out of indigent defense, but was apparently ultimately paid out of their own pocket. I'm assuming that was reimbursed because at the time of the article, I believe that the intention was to call her as a witness, although she was never called as a witness. It was my understanding that she was there for moral support.
Okay. Is it Mr. McCabe? And please be sure to state your name for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dwayne McCabe. I've been a member of the Oregon State Bar since 1974 and have practiced only criminal defense. I was the first director of the Coos County Public Defender's Office, then moved over to Deschutes County, where I was in the Public Defender's Office, and since 1989, I have a contract with Indigent Defense to provide defense services for people charged with aggravated murder, death penalty cases, and murder and other cases if need be. Thank you for giving me and all of us the opportunity to talk about these issues. I would like to just say, and I'll keep this very brief because I know we want to stay on the cases themselves, but the term death is different is one that we hear in capital litigation all the time, and that is not language that defense lawyers have come up with, but that is language out of United States Supreme Court cases. And the United States Supreme Court has recognized that in a death penalty case, there is a higher degree of due process required. The other thing that I would ask all of you to keep in mind when looking at these death penalty cases is that what we deal with are really two trials. We have a guilt trial, guilt-innocence trial, and we also have a penalty trial. They really are two separate trials. They require two separate kinds of skills. They require two different kinds of investigative skills. And you'll hear mitigation, the term mitigation, over and over again. I have learned, I think we all have learned over time, that if a case is going to be returned on appeal or sent back to the trial court from post-conviction or from state habeas corpus or from federal habeas corpus, it is because the mitigation was either not properly investigated or if there was some investigation, it was not properly presented. That's something that we see over and over again. In fact, the only Oregon death penalty case that has been sent back out of post-conviction was specifically on a mitigation issue, that the trial lawyer was incompetent for failing to provide sufficient mitigation. I can be very brief on the actual case that I'm speaking about. I don't know if Mr. Marquis made mention of seven trial counsel as an excess or just a matter of fact, but there have been three trials. Judge Tickton, when he was in private practice, was on the case for a time, but had to withdraw for ethical reasons. So you've had a different set of attorneys on each of those cases. Mr. Marquis' assertion that several psychologists have visited Mr. Guzik in jail is interesting. If there were several, they were not mine. Dr. Cunningham was a psychologist. Is a psychologist, was on the witness list that was provided to Mr. Marquis. In fact, Mr. Marquis interviewed him in my office during the trial. There were no other psychologists that were involved in the case when I had it. No authorization was requested, and none was made. If the jail officers have been providing that kind of information to Mr. Marquis, it's easy for him to check and get names. And again, I would be curious to find out who these people were who were saying that they were psychologists. There was a medical doctor who testified on behalf of Mr. Guzik at the sentencing trial. His name was Gary Jacobson. He was an addiction medicine specialist. Perhaps someone thought he was a psychologist, but that's the only thing I could think of. His name was on the witness list, and he, in fact, testified. The fact that Mr. Guzik has never testified really is of no consequence. None of the death penalty cases that I have tried has my client testified. The only murder cases I've tried where my client has testified is in self-defense. So that fact alone is, it might be unusual in Mr. Marquis' experience, but not in mine. The witness that the so-called pen pal moral support witness, I in fact reimbursed Indigent Defense for that. Mr. Ash, co-counsel, and I reimbursed Indigent Defense. She was on the witness list. Perhaps Mr. Marquis didn't see her name. In preparing a case, we often don't have the opportunity to talk to witnesses as we would like to. This is such a situation. I relied upon information that I'd received from other people. I put her on the witness list. I requested the funds. She did come out to visit. During the trial, I talked with her prior to putting her on and realized that I could not put her on the stand. It would not help Mr. Guzzi's case. That happens all the time, but people don't fly out from London all the time. I felt badly about that, thinking that I should have talked with her sooner by telephone or at least by letter. I did not. I felt responsible for that. It was a significant sum of money, and I did reimburse that after the case was over within a couple of weeks, probably. And that was money that was not from Indigent Defense. That was my own personal funds and Mr. Ash's own personal funds.
Okay. Are there any questions for either of the witnesses? Representative Barker.
Just briefly, did this check come after that article hit the paper or before?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, I'm certain that it came after because the I think the article came out during the course of the trial.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When a psychologist, Ph.D., or a psychiatrist who is going to be an M.D. testify or is utilized in a case, is there a usual and customary fee or is it just negotiated on a case-by-case basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, there is not a customary fee. It has been my experience that most of the experts in the mental field that I've dealt with charge less for indigent cases. And their fees are significantly less hourly than people who are in private practice. But in terms of any set fee, there is not. The policy that is in place by Indigent Defense, as Ms. Christian indicated, does have some outlined amounts, but there's a provision for going outside those amounts for extraordinary situations, and this would be one of them.
Okay, and that's another question, Ann, that I'm going to ask you to put on the list with respect to fees and the process of negotiating fees that the services folks use, and we'll have you back up again at the end of talk about that. I'm afraid if we break, we're going to lose our flow of moving through these cases, and I want to get through a few more before we have to end our hearing time. Is there another question?
No.
Representative Crummell, is there another? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Mr. McCabe, is it normal to have seven different counsels for a case? I assume they were let go and then new counsel appointed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in a retrial situation such as this, it is customary to have new lawyers appointed.
So this wasn't just three? This was one, two, and three?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes. As far as trial three was concerned, Mr. Ash and I were the only ones that were on the case and started and finished.
Okay.
And the case will probably come back again.
So it'll be Guzik 4?
Yes.
Yeah, all right. Representative Ackerman.
Short question, Mr. McCabe. In your experience, does when you obtain pre-authorization, does it come with any conditions such as set hourly rates or caps on the ultimate fee? And if so, how is that communicated to the expert witness?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Ackerman, there is a cap on the fee. In other words, an authorization is for a certain amount, and it is based upon the hourly charge. All of that is provided to whomever is making that decision. And it is, well, I'm certain that each attorney does it differently. A copy of the order authorizing those funds is I send it to whomever the person is, and I also ask them to be mindful of where they are in terms of time and if they do need more money, and sometimes they do, because we don't always know where it's going to lead.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you very much, Mr. McCabe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Marquis, I notice you're still sitting, which means that I think you're probably on number three, too. Am I right?
I think so.
Okay. This is State of Oregon versus Patrick Harned.
It is.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, State versus Patrick Harned was a case tried in 2000. Patrick Harned was 16 at the time he committed the crime. He sexually molested, strangled, and then buried seven-year-old Ashley Carlson in the basement of his parents' home in downtown Astoria, about a block from the courthouse. Because of his age, although it was an aggravated murder charge, obviously the death penalty was not appropriate or available. The case was tried with Griff Healy and Laura Grazier as counsel. They waived jury. The case was tried to the court. Again, it's a case about, although I tried the case for however many weeks it was, the case is under appeal. In fact, I have the first appeal brief by Ms. Grazier here. Just as with the Guzik case, I have no idea how many experts were called, and you wouldn't be able to find out either as long as the case is under appeal. In the Garner case, I know that there was a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a neuropsychiatrist, all of whom testified, an investigator, a mitigation expert, the two lawyers. But the one thing that sort of grated me and why I put it on the list was the addition of a woman named Judy Boughton, who's a local she's a licensed clinical social worker. Ms. Grazier can correct me if I'm wrong. In Astoria, we don't have that many psychologists or social workers, so she's a skilled individual. And as best I could tell, her primary responsibility was essentially to sort of sit with Mr. Harned, who was 18 at the time of the trial, and keep him company. Now, lest you think I'm making this up, I have the appeals brief here filed by Ms. Grazier, and on page 11 of that, she describes the parties and what their, and I assume what they were, responsibility was. It says, Judy Boughton was a social worker hired by the defense to visit the defendant in jail about once a week. She had seen him 48 times by the time of the hearing. She's talking about one of the preliminary hearings. She provided supportive therapy to him, and she sat next to him during the trials, hearings, and at the trial over the state's objection to settle him down. Absolutely correct, as I remember it. Again, it's one thing to have two lawyers, a mitigation expert, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, but a counselor to sit next to the defendant and make them feel better during the trial. I just found out that one a little difficult.
Yes, Representative Shetterly. Ms. Grazier, do you want to go ahead and come forward? Representative Shetterly.
Well, maybe she can answer, but I guess the statement you read in the brief was to settle him down, and I'm wondering, I mean, I've done a little bit of trial defense work as well as prosecution in my years, and I know that some defendants can be extremely disruptive in court, and through that, whatever their problems are and the way they act out, delay the proceedings and impede the prosecution and the defense. And I guess what I'd be interested in is then what the function was, and if it really was settling down. That's different, I think, than babysitting. It depends on how you characterize it. And the other question, Mr. Marquis, it seems to be not pertinent, but your statement here in the letter, in addition to many psychologists, psychiatrists, and neurologists, the defense team, and you have team in quotes. Why do you have the team in quotation marks?
Because it's been my experience that it's not merely a defense lawyer and two defense lawyers. It's usually a team of four or five professionals. Frankly, this is a luxury that no prosecutor in this state can afford. And although I think it's important for counsel, for some, particularly somebody charged with murder, in this case non-capital murder, to get an adequate defense. In fact, most of the time, that's the way they refer to themselves as the team.
Yes,
and I'm sorry, can I answer one other question?
Yeah, yeah.
You asked, and certainly there have been defendants who have been very disruptive. Mr. Harned, at least, and obviously I only saw him in court, never actually showed much emotion at all, didn't testify in the case. And the claim was, and Ms. Grazier, I'm sure, will amplify on it, that he had significant emotional problems, but they didn't manifest themselves in court.
Mr. Chair? Representative Sherrill.
Well, you can cut me off any time when you're on this line of questioning, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm getting a sense here of sort of an us and them, and natural. That's natural, I guess, in the prosecution defense. But you have a prosecution team, don't you? I mean, you have your investigators, you have your You have your support staff. Assume that you occasionally call psychologists to interview, you know, in cases where it's appropriate and permitted, but or to at least to offer expert witnesses. You have a team too, don't you? I mean, this is
not in the same sense, Representative Shetterly. I've tried the last couple of cases. I've tried with my chief deputy. The last case that we'll discuss today, Mr. Simpkins, I tried by myself. Occasionally, during part of the trial, I'll have one of my victim assistance people sitting in the courtroom. Again, I've both defended and prosecuted cases, and I'm not faulting. I mean, in many cases, they may very well need that. I have a certain advantage, is that I'm going with the facts as I know them, and the defense sometimes has quite a challenging job to be able to challenge those facts. But one of the points of my letter, and I'm glad you addressed it, is that there is a common misconception that, particularly in Oregon, that the state has these overwhelming resources, and the defense is threadbare. I'm not suggesting we shift it and start, you know, take all the money from indigent defense. They need the money. They probably need more money than they've got. But I have consistently been outspent in every single murder try case I have ever tried as a prosecutor. I've never hired an expert witness, for example, that costs more than $2,000 ever.
Okay, let's allow Ms. Grazier, who is now probably feeling like she needs to actually talk about this matter.
Chair Williams and Representative Shetterly, I'll get to your question in about 30 seconds. My name is Laura Grazier. I've been a lawyer since 1979. I've been doing capital cases since the late 80s. I think of myself as being more of a law lawyer than a jury lawyer, so a lot of your practical questions about dealing with Ms. Christian's office, for example, I would not be the best person to ask those questions to. I generally do what is called second chair in capital cases. I tend to be the one that's filing the memorandum rather than talking to the jury. I represented Patrick Hardin along with Griff Healy, who has since retired. He was indeed 16 at the time of the crime. It was quite a high publicity case. I do believe that Mr. Marquis will agree with me that Mr. Hardin is a mentally disturbed young man. The legal question was whether or not his being mentally disturbed had legal significance or not. He was convicted of aggravated murder and given a true life sentence by Judge Nelson. That is to say that Mr. Marquis's view prevailed, and I will be looking at the facts in the light that most favorable to the prosecution in that they did win this case. The question that I'm here to address is why Judy Boughton, who is indeed a social worker, was in court. And the answer is exactly because Mr. Marquis was a behavior problem. I'm now going to switch to the voice of Todd Anderson, who was the commander at the time of the Tillamook County Jail, and I will be telling you what he said in the transcript of this proceeding about Patrick Harnett's behavior in jail. I will be referring to him as Lieutenant Anderson, although he's now the sheriff of Tillamook County. Lieutenant Anderson did acknowledge that Mr. Harnett had significant mental disabilities.
I think you misspoke. I've got to go back, rewind the tape. You said that the reason you had Ms. Boughton there was Mr. Marquis was a behavior problem?
Oh, I apologize.
I thought I heard it, too.
I did hear that.
And then I just assumed it was Freud.
You know, just in case somebody else heard that, in defense of Mr. Marquis, I wanted to make sure that was clarified on the record.
I actually thought she was answering his question by stating that's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And then telling
him. Okay, but
it's good that we clarified.
Thank you.
In Mr. Marquis's letter, he said that Judy Boughton was there to babysit, essentially. And Todd Anderson characterized Mr. Harnett as a young man who, quote, hadn't seen the football since the kickoff. And I think that does a good job of characterizing Mr. Harnett. So this is what Lieutenant Anderson testified to in describing Mr. Harnett's difficulties in jail. Anderson spent more time with Mr. Harnett than he had with any other inmate ever in his career. Patrick had numerous behavioral issues. He was very high maintenance. He made a very credible escape attempt with two other inmates. In the escape attempt, he had a wire and a stabbing device. The Lieutenant Anderson took the escape attempt very seriously and believed that Mr. Harned and the two other individuals had made significant steps towards escaping. They couldn't have escaped, but they tried. Mr. Harned was also a suicide risk. He was kept in a single cell for the purposes of officer safety. He had frequent tantrums. He was very immature. He was a constant problem. The staff finally, towards the end, quit writing him up because they had nothing else to do. They put him in isolation and had no other way to control him. He was given powerful psychotropic medication, but he did not appear to respond to it. He continued to be a behavior problem. He became more and more agitated as trial approached, and he, after he was convicted, he was found with another weapon in his cell before sentencing, a sharpened toothbrush. Those were the behavior problems that a very experienced corrections officer testified about in the guilt phase and the penalty phase of Mr. Harned's case. That was the behavior problem that we were facing. That's what the state's witness described his behavior problem in jail. Mr. Marquis, I think, and I will agree, there were no behavior problems in court. We had Ms. Boughton there to, yes, as I put it in my appellate brief, settle him down. He settled down. He was not a behavior problem. That's why we did it.
Are there questions for either of the witnesses on this issue? Good. Thank you both. Thank you very much.
I apologize to Mr. Marcus.
I'm sure it was.
I'm glad to give you the chance to correct that.
All right. We are going to pass over State versus Garner and move to State versus Simpkins.
Mr. Chairman, are you going to be taking Garner up tomorrow?
We are going to be taking Garner up tomorrow. Okay. Does that present a problem?
No. Well, no. I'll be here.
Were you planning not to be?
I was planning on going home at some point, but
okay.
But I'll be here. As originally, the letter I thought the hearing was going to go today, but in the subsequent letter, you did say it would take the 13th and the 14th.
Okay. Can we move on to Simpkins?
Sure. The only thing I'd ask is if you're going to consider the one tomorrow afternoon, if you could consider it towards the end of tomorrow afternoon. The District Attorneys Association has a meeting at noon here in Salem. We have some very critical issues. Some of us won't be available. I certainly want to be able to respond to the questions about the Garner case.
Yeah, that's fine. Be happy to schedule it when you get back in the room.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're at Simpkins.
Yeah. The Simpkins case is different than the others in a significant way. Well, in two significant ways. For one thing, he was found not guilty eventually. Mr. Simpkins and Mr. Garner were originally co-defendants, or they were charged together in the murder of Dana Bailey back in 1998. Ms. Bailey was found stabbed to death on board a boat that was found in the harbor in Warrenton. And then Mr. Simpkins left the boat. There was not really much dispute that the knife used to kill Ms. Bailey was, in fact, Mr. Simpkins' knife. He was found with the knife washing the blood off in a restroom at a bar where he was cooperative with police. Mr. Simpkins told police that a murder had taken place and where the body was. The police went to the boat. Mr. Garner set fire to the boat, destroying the boat and incinerating most of the evidence, including Ms. Bailey's body. Fortunately, she was dead at the time, so she didn't suffer any further. Mr. Garner's case was tried first. He was convicted, found guilty of aggravated murder, and given a true life sentence by a jury. Mr. Simpkins' case followed quite shortly thereafter, and as a capital case. The primary attorneys were both Mr. Fay and Mr. Grazier, both of whom I note are present here. During this first Simpkins trial, it was a capital case. The jury was unable to reach a verdict. It being a small community, the jurors spoke to me afterwards. I learned that they were hung basically 10-2 in favor of guilt, but that many of the jurors didn't feel it was an appropriate case for the death penalty. So I had to make a decision whether to retry the case. I did retry the case, but I removed, both on the urging of Mr. Fay, the defense attorney, frankly the encouragement of the judge, and the comments made by the jurors, I elected to go forward without seeking the death penalty. So the second trial was a non-capital case. A couple other things interceded. Ms. Grazier, who was co-counsel, who had tried the first Simpkins case, came down with pneumonia and was unable to assist, at least at counsel table, during the second Simpkins trial. I was unable also, because of the resources in my office, to have my chief deputy, so Mr. Fay and I tried the case each without assistance, without other lawyers at least there. The difference about the Simpkins case is that because on his second trial he was acquitted, and because he was acquitted, we are able to look at the expenses. The only times when we can do that are three times when the appeals are exhausted, when defendants pled guilty, in which case usually it's not going to be that much because presumably it's been negotiated, or in a case like this where you can actually see how much was spent as a result of a case. Again, Mr. Fay obviously did a very competent job because he obtained an acquittal for Mr. Simpkins. And many of the witnesses who testified, I think, were entirely appropriate. Many of the witnesses who were listed never were called as witnesses, and even that is not inappropriate. I want to make clear. I've been somewhat more detailed about the Simpkins case because, again, I know about the Simpkins case because we have the records. It's attached, I think, as Exhibit B or C. I want to stress that $275,000 excludes the primary lawyers, first Mr. Healy and then Mr. Fay, who I understand are under some sort of contract arrangement where they get paid X amount, like a capitation, for doing X number of capital cases. Mr. Fay and Ms. Christian will have to answer that question because I don't know how much that cost. Shortly after the acquittal, realizing that I would actually for the first time have an opportunity, since I had lost a murder case before, to find out what it cost, I obtained an order from the judge ordering disclosure. The judge signed that order in December. Ann Christian had gathered a great deal of information for me, which I appreciated, and she gave me not only the summary you see, but also copies of the attachments. What struck me in that case, and again, although it was a non-capital case the second time, it was a very serious charge. Mr. Simpkins was facing the possibility of life without parole. There were, I think, 3,000 pages of discovery given by the prosecution, and I think about 300 pages of discovery furnished by the defense. Dr. Cunningham, his name you recognize and will continue coming up, was listed as a witness. These are Dr. Cunningham's notes, the grand total. They're about, 40, 50 pages. Part of the problem in indigent defense expenses is discovery. The report was apparently conducted in, according to these notes, which are very difficult to read, in September 1998. I was given the discovery 3 years later, just before the trial. Mr. Cunningham did not testify, Dr. Cunningham, was to be a mitigation expert. So it would not have been inappropriate to retain him. The other people I've listed, Mr. Akam is a polygrapher. Polygraph exams are not admissible in Oregon, and in fact the Oregon Court of Appeals a few days ago refused an appeal by Clinton Wendell Cunningham out of Douglas County. The claim was that the original attorney was inadequate because he failed to have his client submit to a polygraph exam. The Court of Appeals specifically found that was not inadequate assistance of counsel. Again, it's not a huge amount of money in the scheme of things, about $1,000. Dr. William Sack's name was, I don't believe, ever on the witness list. I believe Dr. Sack is a neuropsychiatrist. It may well be that he was going to be used in the penalty phase. I don't know. Dr. Jerry Larson, $2,235. That's not probably an inappropriate amount. Dr. Larson also, I did not receive a report or, I believe, receive his name. Dr. Larson is probably one of the preeminent experts on drug abuse in the state, and perhaps he was to be used as a witness in the penalty phase if it occurred. Quick Look and Associates, I'm not really sure what they do. They charge $10,000, $10,700. I don't recall receiving any discovery from them. And for those of you who are not lawyers, the rule supposedly is that there's reciprocal discovery requirements.
Okay. But we're not going to talk about discovery.
Okay.
That's not the issue.
I understand, Mr. Chairman. Just attempting to put it in context. The two things that stood out in the Simpkins case was the construction of a boat model. The murder took place on board a boat. So I was informed by defense counsel that they were having a model constructed. And they apparently did have a model construction, I think, by a carpenter. I was asked if I could look at it. I was told I could if I drove up to Port Orford, Washington. That was not an option available to me, so we made arrangements with the trial judge that we were going to take this boat model, which I believe was supposed to be to scale, and place it in the middle of the courtroom. Trial came up, hadn't seen the thing. I asked where was it. They said they weren't decided not to use it. I said, okay, I'll use it, because this is trial number two, and I thought maybe the jury was confused about where everybody was in the boat. I was informed that it had been destroyed because the defense counsel chose not to use it. I believe the exact words were, it's kindling now. Basically, it won't do you any good. I ended up using blue duct tape on the floor of the courtroom to try to indicate to the jury where the parties were. Also, now, not listed on here is, to me, one of the more bizarre expenses, and that is that of Mark Nelson, who, as many of you are familiar with, is a very noted pollster and lobbyist. Mr. Nelson does surveys. And Mr. Nelson was called as a witness and did testify in an attempt to change venue, presumably on the basis that because there had been some publicity about the case, that Mr. Simpkins could not receive a fair trial. And he prepared a 106-page document, which I understand the trial judge, by the way, did not authorize. And this is something of a concern among some trial judges, that sometimes they would specifically not allow something, but indigent defense would. In this case, part of the concern of the trial judge and myself was that in a community the size of Clatsop County, if you contact 500 or 600 people and ask them about the case, you are going to affect the jury pool. This isn't Multnomah County, where there's a million people. The survey also revealed that apparently something like 75% of the people weren't sure whether Mr. Simpkins was guilty or innocent. 3% thought he was innocent. 22% thought he was guilty. There's many attractive color graphs and charts here. A significant part of the survey was devoted to what people thought of me personally. I asked Mr. Nelson when he was on the witness stand in the hearing how many times he'd done these hearings. He said about 12, mostly rural counties. I'd asked how many times he'd asked about the DA personally. He said, only once. I said, why? He said, well, he thought there might be a correlation. I said, was there? He said, no. Now, I'm pleased to report that 77% of those people with an opinion rated my performance as excellent or good, but...
Mr. Markey, it's not about you.
That's right, and it's not about me, and that's why I wondered why Mr. Nelson spent $9,000 of the public's money on a survey about what people thought of Josh Markey. Now, that item was not listed on the list given to me by Ms. Christian, and I got the impression that this is a matter that is in some dispute. But Mr. Nelson did testify that he was billing, at least at that point, approximately $9,000. Finally, in terms of what struck me about the Simpkins case, there were two defense investigator and a mitigation investigator. Even though we never got to mitigation, you'll note that the mitigation expert was paid, I think, about $75,000. And the fact investigator, if you will, a retired Eugene police officer, I think was paid about $80,000 or $90,000. Those witnesses were there most of the time during the trial. When I refer to team, Representative Shetterly, that's the sort of thing I'm referring to, is a couple lawyers and a couple investigators in the courtroom basically all the time. Mr. Fahey also was present for most, if not all, if I can harken back to the first case I talked about, that involving the Jones case. And this is apparently, and again, I don't know whether this is an abuse of defense money or not. I know that I cannot afford to send one of my lawyers and watch an entire trial that might be related to another one. But I know that Mr. Fahey attended most of Mr. Garner's trial, who was the co-defendant's trial. And trying to confine, again, my comments simply to those. Again, there were many expenses in the case that, although they might appear high under the circumstances, I didn't find particularly unusual or extraordinary. It was originally a capital case, and Mr. Fahey, I think, did a fine job.
Okay. With that, then, I've listed the boat model, the Nelson issue, and the investigators issue.
I'm sorry. There's the Quicklick and Associates. They billed $10,700. I'm not sure who they are or what they did.
Okay. So let's bring up the attorneys on the Simpkins case. Is there just one or two?
I'm going.
Okay.
Your Honor.
Sorry, you can call me that, but it doesn't get me anywhere.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you. My name's Peter Fay. I've practiced law for a little over 16 years in Oregon. All but two of those years have been exclusively in the area of criminal law. I served as a deputy district attorney in Lincoln County for over 12 years. For eight of those years, I was chief deputy district attorney. I was a member of the Lincoln County Major Crime Team. I was involved in the investigation, charging, and prosecution of many homicide cases in that capacity. I was also the chair for the 8 years that I was chief deputy of the Lincoln County Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Team. Since January of 2001, I've been a capital defender on contract to Indigent Defense Services. I've had an opportunity, I've heard Mr. Marquis, and I had an opportunity to review his letter, and I apologize. I did not have an opportunity to get my response to Mr. Marquis's letter to you until I arrived here this afternoon. I'd like to say, first of all, I came on this case as second lead counsel. As Mr. Marquis indicated, this case was started out in August of 1998. That's when the crime was committed, and Mr. Healy and Ms. Grazer were the initial counsel on the case. Mr. Healy withdrew in late 2000 or early 2001, and I was in January 30th of 2001, I was appointed as substitute lead counsel. So I came in. And one of the reasons that this case took so long was because that there was some extensive litigation over the jury list. There was a mandamus to the Supreme Court. That's one of the reasons it took so long. The first trial did not commence in this case until November of 2001. As Mr. Marquis indicated, that I have a different recollection. I had different information as to how the jury hung, but that's not our issue. That case concluded December 5th, 2001. It was a mistrial. The case was retried June 11th till June 11th it began. And I think it ended approximately 2 weeks later with a unanimous not guilty verdict.
And Mr. Simpkins, I appreciate the effort you've gone through to detail the case. It's a lengthy letter.
And I'm going to truncate. I've been paying attention.
All right. Good. Thank you very much. If you could just sort of focus on the three or four key issues
I intend
that were raised
to, Mr. Chairman,
on the case.
First of all, the boat. And I know that's the one that's getting the most attention. First of all, that boat model, I still believe it was a good idea. I did not ask for the initial authorization. I was not on the case at that point. Mr. Healy, and I can't even tell you at what point in the case that was when he got authorization to build the model for the boat. But that there was a builder in Port Orchard, Washington, who apparently was contracted to do that work. And this is Mr. Claude Brown. And the initial price was approximately, and this is my understanding, a lot of what I'm going to say here, I have to qualify that I have been told this. Some of this I don't have personal knowledge of. It's what people have told me who were involved in the case. It was approximately $5,000 to construct this scale model, and the defense felt it was very important to be able to demonstrate to the jury the close quarters inside the cabin where this murder took place, where three people were. And that continued to be a very critical issue throughout both trials. The material was supposed to be foam at first, apparently, and then it was determined sometime that foam was not strong enough for the demonstrative purposes where people could actually sit down in it and actually utilize it in court. So the decision was made, and I'm not sure when or by who, to switch to plywood. When it went to plywood at that point, it became a problem. That's where the cost of transportation came in. The cost of breaking it down and transporting it increased substantially. And what I was told was that it was cost approximately another $5,000 or close to it to break down this model at this point and to bring it down to Astoria and to reset it up. And I had initially requested authorization for the funds. I thought, you know, it's already been built. It's something we should really use in the case.
But at this point, I was a little leery about it, and Ms. Christian was even more leery. She called me and expressed some serious concerns about these additional costs of transportation. And based on our conversation, I got in the car and drove up there and looked at the model myself. And it was a very accurate depiction of what the cabin of this boat looked like before it was burned. But it was big and it was fairly unwieldy, and I also recognized that there would be logistical problems in getting it in. This was the courtroom we were trying this case. It's a big old courtroom, beautiful courtroom, but it has very little free space. And I knew the judge would probably have some problem with us rearranging her courtroom to fit this in there, and I didn't want to have to fight that battle necessarily. And all things considered, with the cost being primary, I just decided, and it was a difficult decision, but I made the decision to cut our losses and not use the boat. And I came back, and I had informed Mr. Marquis that the boat was out there and we intended to use it, and I fully intended to bring it down. But then I came back and I informed Mr. Marquis that we were not going to use it. And I have to admit, in hindsight, I wish I didn't say, he asked me, where's the boat? And I said, it's going to become kindling, but it wasn't. At no time, though, do I have any recollection that Mr. Marquis asked me if he could use the model. Because, quite frankly, if he had, I would have invited him to go get it and bring it down at state expense and to negotiate with the judge and where he was going to put it. I would have assisted him. I would have joined him in urging the court to do it. As it was, the model was not. Again, I was being inappropriately glib, perhaps, when I said it's going to be kindling. In fact, that boat model was not. I told him not to touch it because I was concerned. I didn't want there to be. You know, if anybody wanted to look at this and to see what happened, I waited till after the second trial and the acquittal. And negotiated with the builder of the boat. He did not charge us any storage, and we let him recycle the materials that he used for the boat. I'll be glad to entertain any questions on that. I can stop now on that issue if you like.
Go ahead and proceed, and we'll come back to the individual when you're done.
If you want me to skip issues, just tell me, and I'll
the next one, how about we talk about the polling Mark Nelson issue next?
Now, I take issue. I believe Mr. Nelson's role in this case has been mischaracterized by Mr. Marquis. This case, once again, spanned a four-year period in a small community, Astoria, Clatsop County. It is. It's a small town. It does happen to have a good daily newspaper, the Daily Astorian, reports every day, and it's a pretty good-sized paper. It also has a number of radio stations. And from 1998, when this rather sensational crime occurred, the press and the local media had covered every aspect of the case, and you had two defendants. The media covered all of the pretrial motions in the Scott Gardner case, all of the pretrial motions in the first Simpkins case. They covered on a daily basis the entire Gardner trial. They reported on a daily basis on the entire first Simpkins trial. And it was after that when there, and I, as I've indicated in my my written testimony, I remember one lurid headline, something to the effect of victim kept as sex slave. I mean, this was, and that's not necessarily an exact quote, but it's pretty close. And that's what we were dealing with. And I, you know, we'd go out to dinner and we'd have the waitresses, if they, you know, they'd see us enough, they'd ask who we were, and they were giving us opinions about our client's guilt. We were getting a lot of feedback at the motel where, you know, all of this was, and unfortunately after the, Mr. Marquis indicated there was a couple of, I think there were three questions out of 21 questions that Mr. Nelson asked in his survey. And this was a brief telephone survey. And the entire purpose of this survey was to gauge the degree of particularized knowledge that Clatsop County residents who might be eligible to be on a jury had obtained through the media over the course of the pendency of these cases, and whether or not they had formed opinions as to the guilt of our client. We were trying to see if we could still, after all that had ensued and after the first trial, if he could still get a fair and impartial jury that wasn't biased against him because of the media coverage. In addition, after the first trial, the district attorney made some comments to the press that compared my client to another aggravated murder defendant who had a hung jury,
and who was subsequently convicted, and I felt that that was particularly inflammatory. And I think Mr. Nelson is available. He can address the methodology he used. I'm not competent to do that. But we did have a concern about statements made by the prosecution and whether it had, how far it had penetrated into the local psyche. As it came back, the survey came back, there was a high degree of knowledge about the case, and we did go forward with our motion for a change of venue, and it was denied. I take issue with, there's an insinuation that we violated a court order prohibiting contact with potential jurors, and that's not true. I just have to say that, and the judge never ruled such. That's not an issue of expense. If there's questions, I'd entertain them, but I won't go any further in that.
Do you have a comment about the next issue would be the investigators?
Yes. If I just might add, just to tie it on the motion for a change of venue and having that survey done, I feel that if we didn't do it in that case and expend the money, and I believe it was around $8,000 something is what my recollection was, and if there was a conviction, I think we would have been wide open to an attack for ineffective assistance based upon the and post-conviction relief for ineffective assistance of counsel based upon the publicity. So, the investigator. Once again, this case spanned a period of 4 years and two trials. In our first trial, over 50 witnesses testified, and most of them, I believe, are large portion of them were defense witnesses. Most of our witnesses, my client, his associates, and many of the defense witnesses were fairly marginal folks. They lived a transient and very unstable lifestyle. And one of the greatest challenges in the pendency of the case and my tenure in the case was just nailing them down, keeping track of the witnesses. They moved around. They were fishermen. They moved all over the state. They moved all over the Northwest. Much of our investigators' time was spent in, and this is both Mr. Whitney and Ms. Johnson, who is our mitigation specialist, keeping track of both mitigation witnesses and the fact witnesses, and that was critical. And even through their efforts in the second trial, we lost a number of witnesses that we felt were very necessary. And I'm sorry to say this, but this investigation, and I'll tie this in, this investigation of this particular murder, in my experience, was extremely unprofessional and sloppy. I'm not alleging that there was any bad faith whatsoever on the part of law enforcement. To the contrary. But, and I think this was engendered by the fact that the crime occurred in a very small town, and the lead officer who took over the investigation really had no experience. He was from Warrenton Police Department, had no experience in the investigation of major crimes, and it just kind of went downhill from there. As Mr. Marquis indicated, our investigator, Mike Whitney, is a former 12-year Eugene police officer. He's over 6 years as a detective. He specialized in the investigation of person crimes. Spent over 20 years as a various capacities as a private investigator. He has extensive experience in investigating murder cases. And again, a lot of this is anecdotal, what I was told when I came on board, but he went out and beat the bushes and filled in many of the holes in the state's investigation. There was a lot to be done. And point of fact, when the Gardner case came around for trial, the DA's investigator and the lead officer on the major crime team from Warrenton were actually going and confronting witnesses with our investigators' reports that we had provided to Mr. Marquis. So there was extensive investigation and factual investigation involved and developing witnesses, and it was an ongoing thing. Even through the second trial, at the end of the second trial in this case, Mr. Whitney, I called him, he was indefatigable. He was out in the woods of Tillamook County trying to find a very important witness we lost. And he also came up with actually it may have been the same witness. We realized that he had made a statement earlier to Mr. Gardner's investigator. This was found buried in some computer printouts and thousands of pages of discovery, a very important statement that we are not aware of. And he developed that, and he went out and found this guy, and he delivered him to the courthouse, and that man went and provided crucial testimony that we didn't even have there in the first trial. So the investigators, they deserve a great deal of credit, I believe, for Mr. Simpkins' acquittal in this case.
And then the last issue that was raised was the I don't know how to pronounce it, the Swiflick or
Swiflick? Oh, now that's, I dealt with the, now that was a, her name is Chesterine Swiflick, and she is a forensic scientist, a criminalist. She works out of, I believe, as I recall, Seattle or Washington. She's a former criminalist, I believe it was with Seattle Police Department, an experienced criminalist. And she was retained by, initially by Mr. Healy, and she provided a complete workup. This was a case that had quite a bit of forensic investigation by the state, and we had to follow up. We had to check on their forensics. Once again, I was not here for a lot of it, but I did consult with Ms. Swiflick, and I review her perspective on a lot of the case, and she did a complete evaluation of everything from the crime scene, everything the crime lab did, the physical evidence. Once again, that was after I came on that most of her work was done. I consulted with her a number of times. But I think, again, I think it was imperative in this case to retain a forensic scientist to evaluate the large quantity of physical evidence. I mean, the state in this case actually had my client's clothing tested for DNA two separate times at the OSP crime lab. So, again, this was a technically intensive case.
Okay, thank you very much. And I know that you've had to abbreviate your comments, and we do have the full testimony, and I encourage members to read the testimony that was submitted. I'm going to open it up for questions. You've noticed we've lost two members of the committee. They had three 3 p.m. committee meetings, so we scheduled back-to-back. We're going to finish up this round of questioning, and then we're going to adjourn the hearing for the day. We'll come back tomorrow and take the remainder of the cases. As you can see, it's going to be tough for us to finish this in the relative time frame. So I want to encourage us as much as possible, both from the committee standpoint and from the presenter standpoint, to keep ourselves focused narrowly on the issue of extraordinary expenses. So, Representative Anderson, you had a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm mainly interested in the expenses, and would seem to me, wouldn't it be possible to take pictures of or videos of your model and show those in court?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it all you would have seen from the outside was the frame that held the relevant part was inside, and there was a cabin door, basically, and it was like walking into a very close quarters cabin, and actually the interior of the cabin was a relatively small area, but the superstructure that supported it, it just looked like a work in progress on the outside almost, so actually that would have, to take photographs would have,
really?
Would have been worthless. Yeah, it didn't. You had to get inside.
Hollywood can go right into anything pretty well.
No, we didn't. That would have required more expense, I guess, to photograph that. What the initial intention was to be able to demonstrate to the jury people actually sitting inside where the jury could be looking in, and people sitting in their relative positions is when the crime took place.
Can I follow up?
You may.
You make mention here in your testimony four or five times that you were received authorization, obtained authority, received authorization. Who gave all of that authorization?
Indigent defense, Ms. Christian.
Ms. Christian.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question that maybe Ms. Christian can answer again at the end.
Please.
What is a mitigation specialist? For those of us that are non-lawyers, I have no clue what that means. And also, on this spreadsheet that was presented to us as the Confidential Information Oregon Judicial AP Voucher System, there are charges on here of INVF, and I'm just curious as to what an INVF is, because whatever it is worth $32,000.
Do you know what that is? What that charge is?
I'm sorry, I don't.
All right, we'll have Ms. Christian answer that also.
Great.
As well. Representative Crummell.
That's it.
Mr. Markey?
Mr. Chairman, I've just been informed that one of the witnesses on the case is tomorrow, Mr. Frazier, who drove up here from Coos Bay, is not available tomorrow. I'm assuming that the other district attorneys from Mr. Caleb, and I certainly will make myself available tomorrow. But,
and I appreciate that, and I hope you understand our challenge with trying to manage this in a 2 to 2.5 hour hearing time. We have a limited amount of time to do this, and that's why we had extended it over on the Friday, even though it's Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day to all of you tomorrow. We'll do the best we can. Which case is that again, Mr. Markey?
That's State versus Cannon.
Yeah. It's the Gannon case. Oh, it's actually Gannon. And let me check. Ms. Christian, is the defense counsel going to be here tomorrow?
No.
So that's only today that we have an opportunity to talk about this one.
And that would be fine, and I don't think it would be long.
All right, then if thank you both. If you two will withdraw, we'll do that now.
Thank you.
And members that have to leave, you can leave, and I'll sit here and listen to all of it until we're done. But to those of you who can stick it out for a few more minutes, I'd appreciate it. Please, and identify yourself for the record.
Sir, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Frazier. I'm the Chief Deputy DA in Coos County. I've been a prosecutor for 19 years. Ever since 1984 when I was admitted to the bar. The case I bring to you is a case that I had last year. It is not a death penalty case. It's a Measure 11 sex abuse case. I've been a prosecutor, as I said, for almost 19 years, and I have to say I've been very pleased with the defense, and I've never had, prior to this case, occasion to question some of these expenses. This case involved a 9-year-old girl that had been, she woke up one morning to find herself in bed with the boyfriend of her mother with her panties down around her knees, and she was being fondled by the defendant in her vaginal area. The police were called. She reported to her mother. Police were called. They came and interviewed the defendant. He confessed, and it was on tape. Case proceeded to trial. About a week before trial, I heard a rumor that the defense had experts. Despite my request for discovery of any witnesses or anything like that, I had not been told anything. About a week before trial, I found out just quite by accident that they had two experts that had been approved by the state court administrator's office. One was a expert from the Stanford University on sleep issues, Dr. Kushida, and the other was a professor from UC Irvine, Dr. Leo, who specialized in confessions. I asked the defense, what are these guys going to say? I never got anything in writing. The defense counsel told me he didn't know what they were going to say. I said, well, I kind of have a hard time believing that. How can you get an expenditure for this without knowing what these guys were going to say? In any event, I was able to track down that Dr. Kushida had been doing research in the area of sleepwalking, sleep disorders, things along that line, and what the defense wanted was a sleep study done on the defendant to see if perhaps he had done this subconsciously while he was sleeping. My understanding is that funds were expended to have someone come from Stanford to do a sleep study on the defendant in jail. I'm trying to do some research on this real quick, trying to figure out what is a what does the sleep study entail and so forth. I found out that you're allowed to go to sleep on a bed and you're hooked up to monitors, a video camera. You're supposed to be in a soundproof room so it doesn't, outside noises do not influence the test. The reason I started questioning this in my mind is an appropriate expenditure is how can you do a sleep study in a jail, which are notoriously noisy and don't have this type of equipment. Obviously, it had to be brought in. I was later told that they did do the sleep study, but that it was inconclusive, therefore they were not going to proceed with Dr. Kushida. My understanding is the expense in that was around $1,500 to do that, to arrive at that conclusion. The Dr. Leo started doing some research on him real quick, because again, I didn't have anything in writing from the defense as to what was going to be there. Just quickly, he goes around testifying as an expert witness on the issues of false confessions, whether or not a defendant falsely confesses or what have you. I learned that that was probably going to be his testimony. He was going to testify that the defendant had falsely confessed. In my research, looking at Dr. Leo's articles and things along that line, I found that there were certain characteristics of a false confession which were not present in this case. So that I doubted very seriously Dr. Leo would be able to give that opinion. In any event, that opinion would be inadmissible. I moved pretrial to have it excluded, and it was excluded. Then the defense wanted Dr. Leo to testify that, in his opinion, the confession was coerced and not voluntary, which can be a jury question. Dr. Leo came and was allowed to testify on that issue, but his testimony basically was, if the police officer's telling the truth surrounding the circumstances of the confession, then the confession was voluntary. If the defendant's telling the truth about the circumstances of the confession, then the confession is involuntary. I question why we would need an expert from California to testify about something like that, because I would think that would be common sense type of thing. We did not present any experts. We didn't expend any additional funds. It turned out at sentencing the defendant was convicted. The judge ordered him to repay the costs, and that was around, well, he was ordered to pay $6,500 toward Dr. Leo's. We don't know what the final expenditure was there, and he was ordered to pay $1,500 for Dr. Kushida, so that's around $8,000. But again, in my experience, this is one that just really bothered me. I just didn't see the need to spend that type of money on this type of a case.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we bring up the counsel on this case?
I am not, Your Honor. The counsel could not be here for this case.
Okay.
Since I did the authorization, I think I could do this in 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
I think it would be best with Mr.
And I've been told that there are two other district attorneys that I was unaware of that have the same problem that you have, having traveled. The Hernandez, the Manzo Hernandez case and the McKnight case. We're going to do the same thing. I'll stay here as long as it takes and clear my afternoon calendar. You're going to stay with me?
I'm staying through it.
You stay with me, Jerry?
I'm staying for until my staff comes down.
Okay. You're with me, Gordon? All right. So you got the diehards here. And Bill can't go until I tell him he can go. So he's going to be here. So go ahead and do your 3 minutes on this one.
3 minutes. The attorney in this matter, Mr. Chair, was Alan Goldman, and I am the person who authorized the expenses. And I would say that Alan Goldman impresses me as an extremely thorough attorney, and in part I say that because the affidavit that he provided me in support of the sleep disorder expert, quite frankly, was incredible. Mr. Goldman had done substantial research on different sleep disorders. I think I've had two or three requests in whatever it's been, 6 years, for sleep studies. And I'm not a believer as well. Mr. Goldman, and I talked to him yesterday because I wanted to make sure he wouldn't be able to hitch a ride or come up. In fact, he's drafting a letter. I told him that it would be Friday, so we're kind of mixing. But I'll provide that to the committee. Mr. Goldman and I, and he confirmed with me because he very much remembers the phone conversations between he and I, and they were rather heated, and he was quite convincing. And I think, I was going to say, Your Honor, that goes way back. I really do believe that Mr. Goldman had done, because I saw this research, quite a bit of research. He seems a younger attorney, and he and I talked about it yesterday in the context of another request he had before me. It was just by coincidence yesterday. So we had yet another conversation, and I can confirm the amount that was paid out from the state. The court did order repayment by the defendant. I don't feel it was a misuse of funds. I would not go that far, but I'd like to see Mr. Goldman's letter. And Mr. Goldman and I decided yesterday that we both took something away from this experience, and that the request, this wasn't tied at all. I mean, he and I talked about the request that was before me. Coos County is a county where I get very infrequent requests, and part of the thing with reviewing this is you get to know the lawyers, and quite frankly, I didn't know Mr. Goldman, and I know him much better now, and he agreed with me yesterday, at least he said so, that the request that he had pending before me probably was something that wasn't frivolous by any stretch of the imagination. Again, well documented, but it was denied. And by denying something, that just makes the record for the attorney with regard to post-conviction relief. So I'm always I'm happy to go ahead and provide the protection to the attorney of a denial.
Okay, and we will have his letter talking further about the rationale for pursuing the
yes.
expenses.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'll forward a copy. Or thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. And to the extent that you want to respond in some formal way to the committee once you've seen the letter, we encourage you to
feel free to do that
because of a bit of a bifurcation here based on your availability.
Any questions?
Do we have any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, why don't we do the next one, the Manzo Hernandez case?
Chair Williams, while they're coming up, the attorney Dan Norris on McKnight can be here tomorrow, so you don't have to do that.
Okay, if that's fine with Mr. Norris, then that's great. We would appreciate that.
Thank you very much, sir, for bringing me forward first. My name is Edwin Caleb, and I'm the Klamath County District Attorney. I have been so since 1985. Manzo Hernandez, this case took place, I think, in 91 or early, maybe 92. Mr. Hernandez was a Hispanic drug dealer, basically, that was involved. He was in another car where state police officer Brett Clodfelder stopped the driver for DUI, arrested him. The other two had been drinking. Mr. Hernandez and another gentleman had been drinking. So out of the goodness of his heart, Mr. Clodfelder gave them a ride to their home, supposedly, and admittedly made a mistake by not handcuffing the other two when he put them in the car, but they didn't seem to be criminals. And then Mr. Hernandez rewarded him by shooting him in the back of the head four or five times. It was huge for the community. I'm not here at all to talk about the job that Dwayne did, and I think it was Ralph. They did a good job. It's just that the overall cost of it was so shocking at the time. The cost was $996,000 for the entire thing, which at that time, and I know we're not doing comparisons, but at that time was more than the entire budget in my office. Luckily, we got the Attorney General's office to help us do the prosecution, which helped defer some of the costs. The one thing I heard Dwayne testify in the other one earlier, and I do understand defense likes to do mitigation as well as investigation. It's my position, and I know his is different, that an investigator can actually do mitigation. I'm really not sure what a mitigation expert really does, except they get on the stand and they call themselves mitigation experts. Now, I know he's not going to agree with me on that. We don't always agree. But I just think from the prosecution perspective, the investigator, and if the DA is lucky enough to have one, they do it. Otherwise, the state police, up until this year, they probably won't be doing it for a while, are the ones that did the mitigation or the aggravation stuff from our perspective, because we're trying to aggravate the case and they're trying to mitigate it. So that was the cost of about $170,000 for those two. And then on the only other one, I guess it would qualify as extraordinary expenses would be psychological, was $23,000, $18,000 for forensic, and then there's a line item for other experts that I'm sure Dwayne can tell you what were for over $44,000. Now, I know there's going to be some conversation, and I really don't blame defense for this. There's a lot of he was an Hispanic individual, and they had to have interpreters, special interpreters. But it grates me because Mr. Hernandez spoke English very well. And I'm not saying it was up to the defense to point that out to the court. But during the interviews and during some of his drug deals and stuff, we knew that he spoke English. So it's pretty aggravating because of that. So anyways, that's the case that I have.
Thank you, Mr. McCabe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a good example of why the death penalty is so expensive. It is very expensive. We could save a lot of money if we did not have the death penalty. This was the kind of case that Mr. Caleb made a decision that it needed to be tried, and the community and the jury needed to make that decision, and I respect him for that. We talked a couple of times or more trying to resolve the case prior to trial, and we're not able to do so. Again, he did what he felt was necessary, and we did the same in response to that. Let me take first the issue of interpreter. It was not my experience that he spoke very good English. I think he probably spoke English well enough to do certain rudimentary things, and certainly after having been in jail for for a good amount of time, his English got better. But he was not able to communicate well enough to understand what was going on around him, to understand the things that we tried to present. And as Ms. Christian said just a moment ago, you know, I think all of our all the people involved in the system want to see that a case, if it is tried only once. And in order to make certain of that, we have to do certain fundamental things. And one of those is when there is a language barrier, we have to deal with that in a way so that it doesn't come back later, as it has in cases in Oregon, where the person said, I did not understand what was going on. It would be a waste of money if the person was not given an interpreter and the case did come back for that reason. I mean, it would compound the expense. It's important to keep in mind that this case, we went into court, I believe, in the middle of July 1994 with some pretrial motions, a competency issue, and we basically remained in court until February 9th of 1995, with the exception of holidays. That was a very, very long trial in terms of, I believe, all of our experiences. One of the reasons that the expenses are higher in this case is because none of the local attorneys who did indigent defense were able to get involved in this case because of conflicts. There were many, many witnesses, a high percentage of whom had prior involvement with the police and involvement with the defenders down in Klamath County. So it ended up that two out-of-area lawyers had to handle the case. And we basically lived in Klamath Falls for that period of time, which as much as I like Klamath Falls and as fond of it is that I am, it's always better to be in your own bed and cook in your own kitchen. But that had a lot to do with the expenses. A mitigation expert is someone who has special training in the ability to gather together mitigation information. A lot of that is family background. A lot of that is physical, mental issues. And it's someone who knows what to do with that information once you get it. There are many competent investigators who can do both. It is often better, in my experience, to have someone concentrate on mitigation and not get involved in the guilt, innocence part of the trial. It's also been my experience that they don't get paid any more than an investigator. So it makes them feel good to be called a mitigation investigator. It identifies what they're doing in terms of the case, but they are just another investigator. Now, one of the reasons that this case took so long and cost so much money is because the client was not a citizen of this country. His background, his family, all of the pertinent things that we need to investigate in terms of mitigation had to be done out of the area, out of the Klamath Falls area, some of it in California, but the bulk of it done in Mexico. And that is it's time-consuming, and it is more expensive in the sense that you have to have an investigator who either speaks the language or take an interpreter along. And that's what happened in this case. And just turning to the comments that were contained in Mr. Marquis's letter, you know, extensive is one of those words. I don't know what he means by that, but I do know that my co-counsel, Mr. Smith, and our mitigation investigator did go down to Mexico, meet with the family, take pictures of the family home, investigate our client's background, all of which was presented to the jury during the mitigation case. They took with them an interpreter who had family in the area, which helped get through certain doors. Things work a little bit differently in Mexico than they do here. Another point that was made in the letter is the reference to a cultural anthropologist. Now, one of the things we learned very early in this kind of practice is that culture is an important issue. Now, the United States Supreme Court has designated mitigation as any reason, that a jury might decide that a person is entitled to a life sentence as opposed to a death sentence. The Oregon statute sets out certain things to be considered: age, history, family background, mental difficulties, things of that nature. But the Supreme Court of the United States has broadened it to mean just about anything. It's our obligation to look at those things. And we have to do a thorough job, because as I indicated earlier, if a case is going to come back, the odds are it's going to come back because mitigation was not done properly, it wasn't presented properly, and the jury didn't have the opportunity to consider. There's a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case that reversed the conviction out of the state of Washington strictly on cultural issues, the Willie Mack case, M-A-K. He was a resident of Hong Kong who had moved to the United States. It was a horrible situation. It got reversed because the attorney did not take the time to look for an expert who could explain certain aspects of that individual's life and how he might respond in certain ways to certain situations. Those lessons we learn as we go along, and we can't afford not to do those things. So if we have someone from a different culture, it's incumbent upon the defense lawyer to look into that. We don't have that skill ourselves. Our investigators rarely, if ever, have that particular skill. So we end up going to someone like a cultural anthropologist, someone who is familiar with the society, is familiar with the customs, can take a look at our client and try to give some explanation as to what was going on. Now, it is carried into the guilt innocence part as well, because oftentimes you're dealing with Miranda issues, waivers, and culture is a big part of that kind of a hearing. The family, part of the family of Mr. Monzo, did come to Klamath County and testify on his behalf. They were not brought up just to be support. They were there to testify. Now, we may not have called all of them. I don't recall right now. But if we did not call all of them, it was because we decided that we're boring the jury, perhaps as I'm doing to you right now. So.
Okay. Questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Caleb, do you have any idea what the cost to Klamath County was in that case?
Well, there was certainly, because the Attorney General's office, they let us use their investigator pretty much. They had some investigators, and I think they ended up going to Mexico. I'm not exactly sure, but they did that part of it, and Byron Chatfield tried the case for us, so it was very helpful. Had we had to do the investigator expenses, I guess I'll make a plug for the Attorney General's DA assist, because I think they're in another hearing right now talking about this stuff. But it's very important to DAs on these big cases, because my witness fee budget is something like $12,000 or $13,000 for an entire year, so it would have been impossible to do it. But other than that, see, the one difference, and it's not defense's fault, but the one difference is all the prosecutors, the judge, and all the cops that are on these cases get paid anyways, no matter what case they're doing. So it's not costing the people of the state of Oregon a whole bunch of more money to do that particular case, but because what they have to do. And I totally agree with Duane, because I know a lot of this, the costs arise because the defense attorney, in fact, feels that they have to do something to cover themselves at the appellate level. And I think, the real issue for thank God you guys have to decide it, and I do, is to what extent do we have to do that legally? And I think that's your difficult things for you to answer. And I think that's why DAs are talking about, does it have to be everything, or can we look at what other states are doing and decide if that's adequate?
Okay. Representative Cromwell?
Can I follow up?
Yeah, do you have a follow-up? Yes.
Yeah. Briefly, what would each of you suggest to us in ways to cut these kinds of expenses, $1 million for an indigent defense?
I think on death penalty cases are certainly harder than others, but I do know that the, and Ann can correct me if I'm wrong, the Indigent Defense Group in Klamath County negotiates for, all except for murder cases, they take all the cases, and they agree to do all the cases for a certain amount of money. So they don't come rolling back in at the end like some counties. They're out of money after 8 or 9 months, and they have to come back in. I would suggest that you negotiate a contract with people in each county for a specific amount of money, and then let them live with it. Let them live within their budget, just like prosecution has to live within a county budget. Now, I know that might not necessarily work on death penalty cases because it's hard to tell. But I think then, as Christensen would have some type of certainty, you would have some type of certainty when you gave money out that that was all you were going to have to be, and they couldn't keep coming back in for more. Now, again, that's not Ann's fault, and I don't know whose fault it is, but if you had some certainty in budgeting, that's what I would suggest.
Thank you, Mr. McCabe. You want to respond?
Well, I can.
I think I heard your initial response, which was to eliminate the death penalty, but besides that response, do you have another suggestion?
I do. As in this particular case, the expenses would not be as much today because the Mexican Council has opened up an office in Portland, and they have been providing services to us when we represent someone. So much of the expenses that we had to deal with in Monzo are not going to be there. I spent a good portion of yesterday talking to one of the officials at the council. Mr. Caleb and I have another case going with a Mexican citizen. So I think over time, some of these expenses will come down because, one, you know, although the death penalty has been around for a while, it hasn't been around that long in Oregon. We are getting more efficient. And you're not going to see very many seven-month trials. I mean, this was a unique case, and I think that's why it has a unique bottom line. We spent from August until November trying to pick a jury, and that's every day except for court holidays. And we went through 500 jurors before we were able to get a jury. And that's because of the publicity involved and some other issues that that occurred during the pendency of the trial. So this is not a good case to look at in terms of being a model either for required expenses or how to save money. This is a very unique case, I believe.
Representative Crummell.
I don't have any questions.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Archer.
Counsel. I'm so used to going to that end of the table at this point.
Members of the committee, Mr. McCabe, do you know what the hourly rate was for your investigators?
Well, part of the what you see is attorney fees and expenses. Some of that includes investigation because we had an on-staff investigator at that time. My guess is that the hourly rate back then was probably $25 an hour.
$25 an hour. Okay, thank you.
And it hasn't gone up significantly, Chairman.
Is there anything else? I want to thank everybody for participating in the hearing today. I think we're getting better at keeping our comments focused primarily on the issues of extraordinary expenses as we work through this. We'll continue tomorrow. My intent is to bring up the remaining cases and then allow Ms. Krishna to come back up and clarify some of the questions that have been posed during the conversation. We can talk about whether or not there's anyone else that needs to come up in other matters, and then obviously we're going to finish tomorrow afternoon with Mr. Harkelrode and Ross Shepherd from Lane County talking to us about some possible suggestions and solutions. That's both a defense lawyer for Lane County and the prosecutor of Lane County sort of jointly presenting to us some ideas. I want to thank everybody who's, I know, traveled and gone to a lot of work for this, and I just want to emphasize again, I think this is an important process as we have these conversations. Ann is dying to say something on the record. Come on up, Ann. You got a couple of minutes.
Mr. Chair, I have an attorney here from Portland who has to fly out of state, not on business, but yes, on pleasure, and who can't be here, and he's here with regard to Dr. Mark Cunningham. Dr. Mark Cunningham's been involved in a number of cases. One is a case that still needs to be heard, which had Joe Rieke as his attorney, and Joe Rieke has been in trial all week. So Mr. Sussman indicates, and you can definitely say no, that he can do his presentation in no more than 10 minutes.
How am I doing on members?
Sure.
Yeah. You up for it?
Sure.
Jerry?
I'm about to. I think I'm okay.
All right, let's do it.
About 10 minutes.
Let's do it. And then, obviously, who would be the district attorney that would be responding to that?
Thank you, by the way, both of you.
Who would be the district attorney?
Mr. Chair, that is Norm Frink.
Okay, and is Norm here?
No, he's not.
If you don't.
Okay, you know what I want to do? I don't want to do one side and not have the other side opportunity. I mean, who else have I got here? Does anybody want to speak for Norm on this issue? Doug, do you have something?
I know nothing other than I don't know that Norm will be here tomorrow. I don't want you to think he's coming tomorrow.
Okay.
I don't know that.
Well, I'm hesitant, obviously, to put one side on without the other. I'm trying to do this in a balanced and fair way. I'm going to look to the president of the Association for the District Attorneys, and he can give me – I'm going to let this be your call. Do you want to pass on this one without Mr. Frink being present to respond to the discussion? We'll find another time. Would maybe ask both parties to submit the information in writing? That'd be a fair way to resolve it?
Either by writing or by telephone. I don't know if I presume Mr. Frink left for the day, but I was testifying in another hearing
right.
And wasn't here when he left.
And he may have problems. I don't know his schedule, but he may be unavailable tomorrow as well. I apologize that you've come down and sat through this and not been able to do this. You can understand my situation of needing to strike the appropriate balance to make sure that people recognize this as a fair process. I would encourage you to maybe draft us something in writing, and I'd encourage you to have Mr. Frink do the same thing and submit it to the committee for the record, and obviously we can, at a later date if the committee has questions, call you both back to talk about it specifically. Is that fair? Okay. All right. I want to make sure we're being fair. All right. With that, then, we're going to adjourn for the day, and we'll see you all tomorrow. And, again, thank you for your participation.
Right, probably at 1 o'clock, right?